come out sometime later today. I say rules. I'm sorry. Elections and ethics. Senator Devlin, I'm sorry. Abbott. I do believe Senator Farioli will be joining us today, hopefully in a little bit. Senator Atkinson, as most of you know, has been through a bit of trauma in these last couple of weeks. My understanding is he's doing substantially better, but he's not going to be able to join us by phone today. And, Senator Atkinson and Stephanie, I wanted to let you know we're thinking of you and wish you a speedy recovery. With that, we're going to go ahead and get started. Welcome, Senator Monica Anderson. Witnesses, make sure you sign up to testify. I understand we are being taped, but it is not live streamed like we're used to being. So, John, you don't need to be your perfect self.
Okay.
And I'm hoping to try and get through before the noon hour. I think that's certainly possible with the number of witnesses we have in the room. So. And we do have, I'm not going to be able to say her name, Sapita Amadi, joining us as an intern today. Welcome. We're glad you could join us, and I hope it's a good learning experience for you. So, good. With that, we're going to go ahead and get started. Mr. Lindback, welcome. I'd like to have you give us, oh, there he is, an update of the May 2008 primary election process. And with that, we'd like to welcome Senator Farioli. Good morning. Take it away.
Good morning, Madam Chair. I'm John Lindback, Director of Elections in the Oregon Secretary of State's office. I know it seems like the primary was a long time ago, but it really wasn't. And we first prepared this presentation for the House committee, and of course I've updated it since then, since we have more final numbers and so on. Divided... When people ask us, you know, to talk about how the election went, we divided into separate categories of issues and processes, and we'll try to go through each one, give you some numbers, compare what happened this year with life in the past, sort of give you a sense of how different this primary election really was in comparison to primaries in the past. So the first thing we wanted to look at was candidate filing, with the emphasis here on electronic filing. Two cycles ago, we allowed candidates to start filing electronically for office. About a third of the candidates filed in the first year, in the first go-around, electronically. And as you can see, out of the, about a quarter filed the first time around, and we're now up to about a third of the candidates filing electronically, and we would expect that would increase over time as people get more and more comfortable with it. One of the interesting things that we noted this year is that on the last day, when we have the gathering in the House chambers, only one person filed that day in the Capitol. Everybody else was either filing electronically or across the street in our office. So times are changing in terms of how people are doing business with the state and doing business with the Secretary of State's office. The big story, of course, prior to this primary was what was happening with registration. There was massive efforts to register new voters, particularly young voters, in the throughout Oregon and by the Clinton and Obama campaigns in particular, and it showed up in the numbers. We climbed above 2 million voters for this primary, which was unusual. The first time Oregon had ever climbed over 2 million voters was in the general election 4 years ago. And Secretary Bradbury did some publicity on that. And then, as expected, it dipped below 2 million because people move off the list. And then another presidential year rolls around. But generally, we only see this registration increase of this type prior to a general election, but this time we saw it prior to the primary. we had almost 70,000 new registrants prior to the primary election. Quite a bit of that was among new voters. We saw a lot of new voters, particularly on college campuses, so Multnomah County and Lane County. In particular, one of the issues for the fall, I think, is that those college students are going to be coming back to campus wanting to vote in the general election, and a lot of them will be living at new addresses because that's sort of the nature of college, is you don't live in the same place from one year to the next. And they're going to need to be updating those registrations in the fall. So we're expecting tons and tons of updated registrations in the fall. And again, another round of new registrations as well.
So, Linda, can I stop you there in terms of the updated registration? My recollection is that in 2008 we changed the law to make it a little easier for clerks to update those registrations as long as the students are living in the same county. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Okay. Of course, the other trend that we saw was people switching parties. Well, let me go back to the registration increase. Here's the numbers that you can see for primary elections and comparing apples to apples. This 2 million registration for a primary election is an all-time high. The other trend that we saw was party switching prior to this election. Lots of people who were already registered, but they were switching their party affiliation from one party to another, or from not affiliated to another party. The biggest recipient of all those party switches was the Democratic Party. We had almost 75,000 voters switch their parties prior to the general, which of course, that's another new registration card for the county, each county to update. 32,268 switched from non-affiliated to Democrat. Another 19,000 switched from Republican to Democrat. 2,500 switched from non-affiliated to Republican, and 2,412 switched from the Pacific Green Party to the Democratic Party. And those are the largest categories of switches that we saw. The official voter turnout for the election was 58%. We had 1.17 million Oregons vote in the primary election. A high number in terms of actual voters voting, also a high number in terms of turnout for a primary election. Primaries are not anywhere near as high as general elections as a rule. Here was the turnout by party, and you can see that one of the reasons for the turnout was that Democrats turned out in such large numbers. 76% of the registered Democrats voted in this election. 56% of the Republicans voted in this election, 29% of the non-affiliated voters, and then 33% of those voters in a category of other, where they will write down the name of a party that's not recognized on the card, also voted in this election. And you can see how our turnout compares to past turnouts. In the presidential year of 2004, it was 46%. In 2008, it went up to 58%. That's the best sort of apples-to-apples comparison. And here is a comparison of the turnouts by party for primary elections. And you can see that even though the Republicans did not have a contested race in this election, they had a slightly higher turnout this year as well, and so did all categories. Democrats, of course, because of that contested race and all the interest in it, had the highest turnout. Another issue that you may remember was that those people who switched their party affiliation very late in the process may have been mailed two ballots because it was too late to retrieve the ballot that had already been assembled and ready to go, particularly in the large counties where they have such high numbers, it's too late to go back and retrieve that original ballot. And so the voter gets the original ballot and then they get the ballot that updates their registration. And we did quite a bit of publicity about that because of the great amount of party switching at the last moment, the secretary and the secretary of the front office did quite a bit of public outreach on that issue, telling people to return the ballot, only the one ballot. So out of roughly 33,500 people that received two ballots, about 564 did return two ballots. That was, I guess we thought that was a pretty low number in comparison to what we feared anyway was going to happen. Those two ballots, when they come back to the county, of course, in our new centralized voter registration system, are tracked. So if you are issued two ballots in this kind of situation, the county knows it, tracks it. And if the wrong ballot comes back, they hang on to it and wait for the correct ballot to come back and count the correct ballot. And we did a lot of examination in the system to make sure that there weren't any instances of where people who received two ballots and returned two ballots, that both ballots were counted, and there were zero instances of that. So it was tracked and handled appropriately by the counties. The voter's pamphlet. It's always mind-boggling to look at the numbers on the voter's pamphlet. 119 million pages. 1.7 million booklets. Total cost of the voter's pamphlet for this election was $435,800 and change. In a typical primary, fees to candidates cover about a quarter to one-third of those costs. The rest comes from general fund. The most common question from voters about the voter's pamphlet was, why wasn't John McCain in the voter's pamphlet? People were very upset about that, suggested that we left him out on purpose, etc. We did our best to explain that he didn't purchase a statement in the voter's pamphlet, that it's not required. There are a fair number of folks who call our office who are under the impression that it is a requirement for the candidate to be in the voter's pamphlet, and of course that's not true. So we do our best to educate people about that, but they get pretty excited when their favorite candidate isn't there and think it's an error and assume it's an error on our part, and the calls can get nasty. But one of the ways, this is like the second election in a row this has happened to us. The last time around, it was in the general election, and Vice President Cheney elected not to buy a voter's pamphlet statement, and we had the same kind of situation. In the future, what we plan to do is, in the voter's pamphlet itself, print a list of those candidates who chose not to purchase a statement, and hope that that will help clarify the situation for people. Let's talk about Measure 53. As you may recall, Measure 53 turned out to be very close, and for the first time in 14 years, we had a statewide recount this year, and it was the quietest, most unassuming recount I've ever seen. The original vote, there was just a margin of 550 votes. An automatic recount kicks in if the difference between yes and no, in this case, is within one-fifth of 1%, and that was the case. And so it kicked it to an automatic recount. So we did an automatic recount, and here's how the automatic recount turned out. The original outcome again prevailed. It passed, this time by 681 votes. And here's where the differences were in the actual vote count between the yes and no and the original certification and the outcome. As you can see, in the recount, 566 additional votes were counted statewide, 435 additional no votes were counted statewide, and that, of course, would raise the question as to why. This is standard in optical scan voting. When people fill in the oval or mark the box in some way, they don't always do it with a strong enough hand for the optical scan reader, the tally machine, to count it. And so it will read as an undervote, meaning there is no vote there, because if you went in, if I had a stack of ballots here, you would see some of them very lightly marked by voters, despite instructions. And so what happens then is you get into a hand recount situation where humans can actually look at these ballots and they can tell there's a vote there, and so they're able to count that vote. We compared the actual number of additional votes, which is quite standard. In most recounts, you'll see additional votes, to past recounts, and we're considerably under past recounts. I could only attribute that to the fact that we don't have punch cards anymore, and you know, there's been lots of national studies to show that people make fewer mistakes and undervotes with optical scan systems than punch cards. And of course, in the intervening time since we had our last statewide recount, we've had a wholesale switch from punch card voting in Oregon to optical scan voting.
Don, when was the last time we had a statewide recount?
1994, and it was a statewide measurement. Well, there was a recount in a primary election for a Democratic primary in the year 2000 in the treasurer's race. It doesn't really compare to this, because this is where we were recounting something that appeared on every ballot, not just the Democratic ballot. And so the last sort of comparable recount to this is in 1984. 94, excuse me. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about election night reporting. For the first time, we instituted in a primary election at the Secretary of State's office the ability to go to our webpage and see the results on election night as they're coming in. We had some issues that night with our ability to keep up with the load on the system. It was a pretty unusual election, as you all may recall, because the entire world was watching Oregon election results that night. And it was pretty fascinating. If you had the TV on and were watching results, they actually had little clocks in the corner where it was like 3 minutes to, you know, 8 o'clock deadline in Oregon, and it was like ticking down by the second. And the minute we hit 8 o'clock, our website was just overwhelmed with hits, and we had a lot of trouble that night keeping up with the demand. We're working on that, of course, for future elections, but I don't expect that we're going to have another election like that in a long time, where Oregon was the only focus of the whole world at that particular time. On general election night, people are watching a whole lot of states all at the same time. And it isn't exactly the same kind of situation, but we think our pages look good. They were easy for people to understand. They were, even though we had those problems on election night, they were certainly well used by the public on election night and the days afterwards as people followed the election results. In the past, the Secretary of State's office has not done this, and it's been a function of the media in Oregon. We had a lot of calls where people were just sort of dumbfounded that they couldn't find results at the state level, and I certainly agreed with that. It's a reasonable expectation by the public, and so we instituted election night reporting a couple of cycles ago, and it's sort of been quietly integrating it into the way that we do business. I'd like to talk about campaign finance for a little bit in regards to this election. Under the new the electronic reporting system, we had 1,939 statements of organization filed. We had a grand total of 267,412 transactions in this election filed in the electronic system, or ORSTAR. And so that sort of gives you a sense of, for the first time, I think, we, in the past, we've always had these reports. where there wasn't any sort of summary of the general amount of activity, and we're going to be able to track that from now on because we're tracking things on a transaction-by-transaction basis. Call center statistics. You may not be aware of it, but we have a call center that is manned by folks at OSCI. They do work for both the corporations division and the elections division at election time. They're able to answer people's very basic questions about elections. They forward calls that are more than basic to the county election offices or to our offices. As you can see, it's a toll-free number for people to call if they have a question about their ballot or their drop site or whatever. You can see the great amount of activity prior to an election. This has been a tremendous public service, having this call center. In the past, a lot of those people that called just got busy signals and perhaps, you know, went away and never got their question answered. But now we have a way for the very basic questions to be answered and for them to have a person on the phone helping them. So in May we had, as you can see, in excess of 9,000 calls handled by the call center.
John, what's the cost on that roughly?
You know, I'm not sure.
Okay.
I'd have to get back to you on that. It's reasonable, very reasonable. It is a 1-800 number, or a toll-free number, is a requirement of the Help America Vote Act. So we are required to offer people a toll-free number under the Help America Vote Act for them to voice concerns or file complaints if they have any about the act of voting. We decided to expand that so that the toll-free number is available for that and the general information purpose as well. So this is a function that has been paid for with the Help America Vote Act funds. Most common concern we've got in this election, unofficial drop sites. Lots of concerns from elections officials, from the public about and worries that organizations, campaigns, are setting up drop sites, collecting ballots from people, and is it safe? Are those ballots making it to the counties? Are people being too trusting, et cetera? We didn't have any indication that there was a problem with the ballots not making it to the counties, and we never have. We did have a lot of calls about it, though, and it continues to be a perception problem more than a real problem, I believe, a perception problem that sort of affects people's sort of unease about the vote-by-mail process and draft sites in general. I think it's important that when we talk about elections to focus on the complaint that we get most often, and this one is the complaint we get most often about the election process.
Go ahead.
Just talk about that. Thank you, Senator. What is the penalty if someone should set up an unofficial drop site and somehow defraud voters? Or is there a...
it would be a criminal penalty if you you messed with somebody else's ballot and, you know, with intent threw it away and or didn't deliver it or whatever. And there are penalties in place, but we've never had a case like that. You know, we could pursue.
And do you know whether it's misdemeanor or felony level?
I'd have to look. Maybe one of my staff people can look it up.
Great.
Thank you.
I knew you had a question.
Well, there are a lot of elderly that truly don't have the stamp. And churches, I know, assist their parishioners with collecting ballots and putting them in.
There's a... there's sort of two things that go on there. A lot of times, particularly in college campuses where the county, you know, doesn't have a drop site on a college campus, a student organization will set up, for example, an unofficial drop site in a box. Then there's the other thing that happens, which is wandering from house to house offering to deliver ballots for people. We see that with campaigns. We see that in what you're talking about. And those people, it's sort of murky, the collections, as to whether or not that actually constitutes an unofficial drop site. We always counsel people to label themselves as an unofficial drop site if they're doing a collection effort, but it's really questionable under the law whether they're required to do that. And that comes up from time to time, and legislative committees and us, you know, we've all sort of looked at it and went, well, we don't quite know what to do with this, and we've never had a problem with it, and everyone kind of looks at each other and let's wait and see what happens.
And I would agree. Even when I was door knocking, a couple of instances, they were always elderly, say, oh, would you please take my ballot? And I thought, oh, my lands, what if I'm in a car wreck and it never gets to the to the ballot box, I mean, to the election committee.
Secretary Bradbury, usually prior to each election, does some public outreach on, you know, take responsibility for your own ballot, take it to the drop site yourself. Fortunately, we haven't had a problem. I think it would be fair to say, though, that the county clerks and myself, we do believe that this is a problem where there's something, you know, it's sort of waiting to happen out there. We're living on borrowed time here, and sort of lucky that nothing has happened so far.
And John, I just, on this whole issue of the unofficial, I assume one of the reasons why we don't have more official drop sites for counties is the cost issue, staffing and making sure the ballots get picked up, making sure they're under surveillance, that sort of thing. And so it's really a cost issue for the counties, and particularly we have some counties struggling right now. It would be really hard to expand those services with dollars so tight.
Yes. That is correct. And we have in the vote-by-mail manual, which is the Bible of rules that the counties follow to conduct a vote-by-mail election in Oregon, a requirement that you have in your county a minimum of two drop sites, and then at least one drop site for every 30,000 voters. And the counties do their best to distribute those around to convenient places. Their largest concern has always been security of the boxes and the ability to find somebody that they can rely on that they will deputize to handle the security and watch those boxes and make sure everything goes well and there are no problems.
But even so, in our some of our larger counties, two drop sites may not be very many.
Oh, well, in the larger counties, at least one for every 30,000 voters kicks in. So there's
no
many more.
No, I mean
than
the
that.
Larger counties by size, not by population.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you know, the clerks, I think if you looked at them, it would be a pretty rare county that only had two.
Okay.
That's a minimum. You know, there's some, you know, Wheeler County, for example, which has less than 1,000 voters. They might have two. Yeah. Generally, you know, I know in Malheur where they have a drop box, you know, something like a couple of hundred of miles away in the far south part of the county. You know, they know that it's important to have one way down there, and that's just one issue they need to deal with on election night, is getting down there and getting those ballots and getting them in on election night. So on to the general election. Those are the categories of issues and numbers that I was thought you might be interested in, but I'm certainly willing and able to answer anything else you have. In terms of your question about the penalty, it is a Class C felony.
Okay.
It's 260715 sub 5.
And on the voters that received two ballots, we had about 560 some that voted twice. I assume the first ballot was automatically tossed out then, and the second ballot was the one that counted.
You're correct. The second ballot counts the one that's appropriate to their registration. So in the process, when the counties know that two ballots have been issued, and when the first one comes back, the system warns them that it's the first one, and they know that the process is that they're to hang on to that first ballot. If that only the first ballot came back, they would count the races they could from that first ballot, because the person may not be eligible any longer because of the change in registration to vote the entire ballot, and so they would count what they can.
And anyway, in the future, assuming we have it, let's assume in the 2010 election that we have all this excitement and we have another, whatever, 50,000, 100,000 voters switching parties. Any thoughts on how to avoid the two-ballot issue for the future?
Well, there's two ways to approach it. We could talk to the counties about their processes. I think it's probably pretty unrealistic, particularly in the larger counties, where they have to start the process of putting the ballot packets together well in advance, that they're going to be able to do much about that. I've been asked that question before. I think the sort of most logical answer is that you move that deadline by which you have to switch, in which you can switch parties, that you move it further back from the election.
Okay.
And if you gave the counties, if you moved it back 2 weeks from where it is now, that would solve most of the problem.
Madam Chair, there's a lot of people that feel, well, there needs to be same-day registration.
Right.
And so this is just compound saying you're discriminating against us too.
Yeah, I mean clearly I think that what this shows is the system is able to handle it, and so it's a perception problem more than a real problem, the fact that this bunch of voters got two ballots. It's a perception problem and a fear that people are voting twice. They're not, so it's really more of a perception problem than not. I think it's for all of us a question of whether or not we want to just continue to live with that perception problem and deal with it, or is the perception problem bad enough that we should move that deadline back?
And that, again, may highlight some of the issues with the same-day voter registration and the ability to do ballot turnaround.
Correct.
All right. I guess no more further questions on the primary. Let's move on to the general, which is how many days away?
Less than 100. I think we're down to 90 now, aren't we? Yeah. All right. So I'm done in terms of talking about the primary election.
I don't know. Yeah, I think we're done. We're good. So.
Okay, so you want to talk about House Bill 2082 now?
So.
Another presentation up here. Okay, House Bill 2082, as you all know, is the bill that made numerous changes and substantial changes to the initiative and referendum process. And again, I'm going to handle this in the same way. I've divided the changes in the law into different categories, and we'll sort of address them one by one. As you may recall, the first new requirement of House Bill 2082 was that circulators who circulate petitions for pay are required to register and receive training from our office. We placed that training online. We distributed copies of it to the companies that hire circulators. We had 271 people registered as circulators. The new law, as you may recall, said that if you have a fraud conviction in the last 5 years, you cannot be registered to circulate for pay. We had one person who was not registered because of a past fraud conviction. We had 17 circulators suspended for providing incomplete information on their registration form. Most of the problem there was assumed names. We did background checks on each person who registered and had found assumed names that they had not given to us in the registration process, and so we were not able to register them. The second area of the law, and this is one that didn't get a whole lot of attention in terms of being major changes, but it was in regards to templates of signature sheets. You may recall that that in the past you got your ballot title and then you came to the elections division and you presented the elections division with your signature sheet that you wanted, and we would say, no, that doesn't work. No, that doesn't work. And the petitioners may go back and forth with us three or four times trying to make us satisfied that it was in compliance with the law. With this change in the bill, it changed it so that the chief petitioners didn't have to do that anymore, that we would simply provide the templates of the sheets for them. And so in the 2008 cycle, we had 37 templates that were provided for petitions. We've already provided templates for 24 petitions in the 2010 cycle. One of the issues we ran into this, by the way, was we're required when people submit their request for the templates to respond within 3 days. We had one petition that for the 2010 cycle, we responded within 3 days for their sheets, but they aren't allowed to circulate until after the 2008 cycle is over. They actually went out and started circulating before the 2008 cycle was over, and because they had the templates, and we're not going to be able to count any of those signatures. So they, of course, were horrified to learn that. One thing we may want to consider is that we do not issue templates, you know, if we make any changes in the future to this law, that we do not issue templates for the next cycle until the current one is over, so that people don't get confused about that. One provision of the law that turned out to be I would say sort of the most contentious was the issue about accounts disclosure. As you may recall, the law requires chief petitioners to submit to us financial information that we're supposed to review and that will show help us determine that they are in fact paying their signatures, their circulators, that they are not paying by the signature. This was a provision of the bill attempting to bolster enforcement in Measure 26, because there was a considerable amount of concern that Measure 26 was being ignored and violated. So here were the numbers in terms of the 37 petitions that were required to provide accounts to the Secretary of State's office. 13 of those petitions submitted complete information. 4 submitted incomplete accounts and were suspended. 10 did not submit any account information and were suspended under the new law. 6 did not submit any account information but were withdrawn by the chief petitioners. And 4 are still in process. The accounts that submitted complete information, this is the following list, and you can see which ones qualified for the ballot. Petition 3, 19, 20, 40, and 41 submitted their complete information and all qualified. Others fell into those other categories where they were either withdrawn or simply, we're not able to submit provide the required information to us, and so we're not able to collect more signatures. And this is continued from the previous page, 108, 109, and 1012, submitted complete information, 109, the top two primary qualified to the ballot. These are the petitions that were submitted incomplete accounts and were suspended. Petitions 51 and 53 were the subject of some litigation, and the state has prevailed on that litigation so far. There's still litigation alive in federal court on this issue. Here were the petitions that did not submit any account information and were suspended. As you can see, two qualified.
Both 21 and 25 are going to be on ballot.
Because
they're qualified for the ballot.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So what impact did the suspension have then on those two?
Well, it didn't, because these are petitions that circulated prior to the new law taking effect. So they had already qualified before the account information provisions kicked in.
Okay.
She's nodding yes. These are the folks that did not submit any account information but were withdrawn by the chief petitioners. And these are still in the process. As you recall, one of the issues that we all talked about was how this bill would, major provisions of this bill would kick in the middle of the cycle, and what sort of effect that might have on all the petitions that were on the street. One of the things that was required by the bill was that for those people that were circulating in the prior calendar year, that they turn in all sheets circulated in the prior calendar year under the old law on January 4th, so that we had all of those sheets segregated for our processing, because we were going to have to deal with sheets that were subject to one set of laws and another group of sheets that were subject to the new law. So that worked in terms of making it a little easier for us to deal with those issues. But as you can see, the great number of signatures were still collected in this cycle under the old law. There clearly was an effort by the chief petitioners to hurry and complete their signature gathering before the new law took effect. So there were 1.2 million signatures gathered before House Bill 2282 took effect, and 180,132 gathered after the new law took effect. And this breaks it down for you in terms of each individual petition that shows how many signatures were gathered before House Bill 2082 effect and how many after. You can see very few signatures among these five that qualified that were collected under the new law. Really, the petition that really, there was only one petition really that circulated entirely under the new law, and that was the top two primary petition. And so in terms of making any sort of strong conclusions about how the new law works, I'm not sure we're there yet, because there wasn't that great enough of activity under the new law to reach any strong conclusion.
Where are we with litigation in terms of House Bill 2082?
The state has prevailed in two rounds of litigation so far, and there is one lawsuit still active in federal court. It is not expected that, that part of the effort there is to keep anything on the ballot, off the ballot or on the ballot. It's expected that that litigation would be about the law itself. And so we do not expect, at least thus far, that this litigation is going to be something that's a rush to try and complete before the certified ballot deadline for the certified ballot state. Let's talk about validity rates this cycle. For those petitions that made the ballot in the 60s, they submitted a lot of signatures, obviously, to have validity rates in the 60% range, or in the mid-60s, and still qualify. And 51 and 53 were the ones that had insufficient signatures for proceed. Part of the reason for that, of course, was they were suspended for their failure to provide adequate information on the accounts. You can see that there was one petition that had a higher, substantially higher validity rate than the rest, and that was the top two primary petition. I'm going to be real blunt here. I think this has a lot to do with management. This was a particularly well-managed petition. We can tell that from our end by how much attention that the folks are paying to the details. I think it does show that you can circulate a petition under the new law and do pretty well with regards to validity rates and submit your accounts and do it properly. It cannot be ignored that their validity rate is that much higher. Another part of the new law, as you may recall, is that in order to get a petition these days, instead of submitting 25 signatures under the old law, you have to submit 1,000 now. We have verified the sponsorship signatures on two petitions for 2010 under the new provision for verifying 1,000 signatures. We had to go round and round and round about how to implement this, and the way that we implemented it was, well, first of all, I think our assumption was, and the discussion, as I recall, in committees, was that we weren't going to be verifying these, that they were simply going to be put in our vault, and that the 1,000 signatures would count towards the end product. Well, when we looked at the language, it wasn't so clear as passed that we weren't supposed to verify them. So, okay, so we have to verify them. Well, so we're doing this without any, we ended up doing this without any resources, extra resources, but we're percolating along here. I'm a little worried about the next cycle where we may have to do a lot of them. This way. But the way we're handling this is we do a statistical sample on them, and if they don't make it in statistical sampling, we go through and do a full verification and look at every signature. And on the first petition, you can see it required a complete verification after it showed they did not have the required 1,000 signatures. It required a second submittal of signatures by the petitioner, and so they've done that, and they've made it. The second petition, it required complete verification again. We had to go through and look at every signature, but no second submittal was required, and so they made it. And the reason that we went to this process, we worked with our consulting statistician, the number of signatures that they need is so small that statistical sampling is not as accurate in a group of signatures that small than it is in terms of a very, very large petition we're used to dealing with. And so that's why we went that route. Um, 27 petitions were submitted prior to the 1,000 sponsorship signature requirement kicking in. People were obviously very aware of the law. And then two of those have been approved to circulate so far.
These are all for 2010.
Right. All right. So that's my report, Madam Chair, in terms of implementation of House Bill 2082. I think, overall, in terms of summary comments, we've had our rocky moments both on the part of the state side and the chief petitioner side. We expected there would be, but overall it's gone pretty smoothly. The sort of most difficult, contentious part I indicated was the accounts. I think people, we had to change our rule a couple of times. We're giving people adequate notice on that in order to make sure we're getting the information we need from the chief petitioners in order to do our jobs to ensure that Measure 26 is being complied with. So that's...
The top two had a substantially higher validity grade than many of the other signatures gathered during this election cycle.
Right.
Were some of the same firms used to gather the signatures for the top two that were used for the other initiative petition?
I don't think so. I think there was one firm that worked on the most of the others, one or two, and then on the top two, there may have been a little overlap between one of the firms that worked on the top two primary and some of those other petitions, but there was one firm that worked, as far as I understand, just primarily on the top two primary petition this cycle.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate you joining us this morning.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the handouts as well.
Sure.
We'll make sure Senator Atkinson gets this so he can read them as recovery.
Okay.
Let's move on to the next topic at hand, legislators' use of campaign dollars. I think I've had conversations with committee members. I'd like to start the discussion about how we move forward on this issue. I see it as being tied to our legislative salary increase, which I'm going to have the commission come talk to us about, but we're in the discussion and I want to hear input from colleagues. Senator Ferrioli, specifically having spent many hours driving around the state at this point in my life, specifically concerned about the time and energy that legislators from rural parts of the state are spending to serve in the legislature, and want to be very cognizant of that issue. So with that, Ms. Johnson, are you here? Come on up. Thank you. I really appreciate you joining us today. I'd like to hear a little bit about the background and what you see as the project for your commission during this financial interim.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak to you. My name is Doris Johnson, and I have the distinct privilege of being the chair for this commission for the public officials compensation. And I have a handout for you that you're being given at this time, and I would just like to highlight parts of that for you while you do it, and then I am certainly available for questions afterwards. So to begin with, the 2000 Legislative Assembly revived the Public Officials Compensation Commission, as outlined in the Oregon Statute 292.907. The mission of the commission is stated there for you, and it's generally to build a recommendation for elected officials' salaries, and we are to consider total compensation, including benefits other than salaries, salaries for comparable positions in our neighboring states, qualifications and skills necessary for each office, the level of responsibility, the cost of living, budget limitations, and any other reasonable and appropriate factors. So that is our mission, and we keep that in mind as we're moving through this process. The 11-member commission is listed there for you and how they were chosen. as I understand, was a very unique process in choosing a commission. It has worked out very well, and it is just a pleasure to be working with this variety of members of the commission. To date, some of the activities that the commission has been involved in are listed. We've toured the executive branch offices. We have been interviewing current and past office holders, especially of the executive branch. We began with the executive branch, and we've been gathering information regarding their duties, their skills, their qualifications. We've been looking at and reviewing historical data on salaries and benefits for these positions. We've reviewed data for equivalent positions in our neighboring states. By statute, we are required to do that, and we are reviewing data for equivalent positions in the comparable states. So the commission has had several discussions, policy discussions, and one of those has been how to define comparable states, which states are comparable to Oregon. So beginning with the executive branch, we used information from our state economist. He provided the commission with state comparisons of population and per capita revenue, expenditure, and income. Based on that data, we were able to identify 9 states that are comparable to Oregon in at least 2 of those 4 categories. Those 9 states are Iowa, Louisiana, Michigan, Mississippi, North Dakota, Ohio, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Wisconsin. So those states, along with the neighboring states of California, Idaho, Nevada, and Washington, comprise our list of what we call our comparable states when we are viewing, at least for the executive branch. We understand that every state is different, and so some of these states may not be used when looking at all of the positions. For example, one or more of these states may not have an elected position equivalent to Oregon's elected position. But for the most part, that those are the comparable states that we're looking at. So to date, the commission has reviewed data on the executive branch. We met this week, Wednesday and Thursday, and we have reviewed data on the judicial positions. We are considering for the judicial branch the median salary, including benefits, for comparable states. The Chief Justice's report on compensation used the 12 Western states, so we're looking at that, along with the comparable states that we used for the executive branch. We're kind of in the middle of decision-making as far as determining comparable states for that branch of government at this time. We have also begun to look at the legislative branch yesterday, and we are just in the beginning process of the legislative process. So with regard to legislator compensation, the commission members are very well aware of the diverse nature of the service in the legislatures across the country. The commission is reviewing its options for legislative comparables at this time, and we continue to review data, and we ask for your assistance in gathering any firsthand commentary about service for the Oregon legislature that you might be willing to assist us with, or any information that you have or advice that you have for us on that. We certainly are open to hearing from you. So that is the progress report at this time. We've gone through all of the data and have tentative recommendations for executive branch, judicial branch. We're continuing to collect data. We have most of it. We're deliberating on exactly which comparables to use, and we're just beginning the process for the legislative branch. Through the summer and early fall, we will continue to deliberate on the recommendations for the elected officials' compensation. We have a public hearing scheduled for September 18th, and our final recommendation will be approved by the commission by October 10th, where it will be submitted for the governor's inclusion in his budget, and that will then go to the Legislative Assembly for approval in the next session. If you would like additional information, any detailed information, please feel free to visit our website, which is listed there for you. Our minutes, our audio files, handouts are all available to you via that venue.
Ms. Johnson, just to clarify, my recollection is that it covers both the legislative salaries, the executive branch, executive office's salaries, and also the judicial, both the trial court, Court of Appeals, and Supreme Court.
That is correct.
Okay.
Circuit Court as well as court.
Okay, good. You are spending an enormous amount of time in participating in this commission. We really appreciate your service and the other members of the commission as well. It's going to take a great deal of work to get this done by October. Holy smokes.
Any questions from the question?
When you get to the legislative, looking at the legislator compensation, it'd be interesting. Each legislator, the amount of time they spend doing legislative work really varies. Some are very, very involved in their community and are asked to speak in neighborhood associations, civic service groups, et cetera. Some get a lot of, respond to constituent complaints far more than other legislators. I'm wondering, will the commission be looking at that also to get an average, or?
Yesterday, the commission spoke with four senators, Senator Ferrioli being one of them, and that's probably why he's chuckling, because he can see the, it is a huge task, and that is a question that has come up for us. We're looking at everything. We're not sure right now exactly how we're going to come up with a recommendation. We understand that every senator, right, every legislator has different responsibilities. No two schedules are alike. They have different loads. They have a different area for which they have to cover to speak to their constituents. Which we're leaning toward looking at their term while in session, their workload responsibilities while in session, and possibly using a percentage of that or some variation of that as compensation not in session. It would be impossible to compare every single legislator and try to compensate them for their workload because there's such a variety. So in that respect, if you have any suggestions, any advice for us, any key formulas, we certainly would be open to hearing it.
Ms. Johnson, I think you just found a way to pay the good legislators about 15% more than the not-so-good legislators.
At this point, we're saying not more than $75,000 a year.
Ms. Johnson, the other question I have is the consideration for rural legislators and those of us living in the metro area. I mean, I certainly have colleagues that have to drive many hours to get to the Capitol, spend... how many counties do you have?
12 counties. All our parks, starting in Maryland and Clackamas, and ending at the Idaho-Nevada border. Used to.
Not anymore.
No, that was...
We took that away from you.
Be
more Democrats in
the district that are fairly electoral.
So anyway, any consideration on how you're going to address the issues of rural versus urban legislators and travel districts and anything like that?
Well, I think the best thing I can say right now is we just began the legislative branch yesterday, and it's a little premature to try to predict what the commission is going to do at this time.
And it's the fact that I think it's fair to say the legislature is looking at annual sessions. Has that come under discussion as well?
It has come under discussion, yes. We are aware of that.
All right. Thank you very much. We really appreciate you traveling to join us today.
Again, thank you for the opportunity.
Okay. All right. Next up, Mr. Johnson, thanks for being willing to leave the Capitol to join us today. We understand you have moved into your offices.
Madam Chair, members, good morning. Dexter Johnson, Legislative Council. Yes, I particularly appreciate the chance to return to the annex where we spent so many lovely months and revisit the joy of being in this building.
Madam Chairman, I like this building better than it was a furniture store.
All right, thank you. Take it away.
Madam Chair and members, staff has handed out a memo from Deputy Legislative Counsel Gina Zedlick to myself that summarizes the current status of Oregon law on the use of campaign funds, or I should say excess campaign funds, that is to say contributions that are not spent directly in campaign expenditures but are spent otherwise, and what the limitations on those expenditures are. The primary law in question, RS 260.407, generally provides that you may use these excess campaign contributions for any expense incurred with respect to either your status as a candidate or your duties as a holder of public office. You may transfer those monies to a other political committee, either national, state, or local level. You may make a contribution of those monies to either a government entity or a charitable organization. Both of those are described in Section 170C of the Internal Revenue Code. That's the section that permits individuals to deduct from their taxable income amounts that they, as individuals, donate to charities or to, as occasionally happens, government entities.
Madam Chair,
sorry,
does that also include, because I don't remember, churches and and foundations?
It does. There is a limitation in that section that it may not be an organization that spends more than X percent of its time, and it's a pretty low threshold, attempting to influence legislation or the outcome of campaigns.
And I'm thinking of, say, the community college foundations.
Madam Chair, Senator Moniz Anderson, my understanding of education foundations is those are organizations that do fundraising to gather money for capital expenditures or that sort of thing for the institutions, and that would be fine. There are a number of limitations that under existing law where you could not use campaign contributions, and by far the most significant of that, and it's kind of the theme that runs through the all of the law in this area, is that you may not use campaign contributions for personal use. So if it's in connection with a campaign, it's not personal use, it's with respect to your status as a candidate, but any expense that is something you would incur whether or not you were a candidate or whether or not you were a public office holder, not by terms of the statute but by terms of the administrative rules adopted by the Secretary of State, that would be considered a personal use and would be a use of those funds for that purpose would be prohibited. You may not pay legally.
Do we have examples of that type?
Yes.
Of expenditure now, do you have?
The Secretary of State, in their manual, has examples of prohibited expenditures, and you will see a list of those beginning on page 2, examples of prohibited personal use. Things like gifts to campaign volunteers, purchase of household items, clothing, payment of mortgages or rent,
entertainment expenses.
And rent not for your campaign office, I presume, but for your personal living
correct.
Space.
It's obviously for your personal residence or any other real property. So if
there are some of us who live in the metro area, but we then, well, a lot of us that even live outside the metro area, we rent an apartment here in Salem. So campaign funds could not be used to pay the rent of our apartment that we are renting down here in Salem during session.
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, that raises a very interesting issue. Let me say, first of all, that the expense, let's set aside the per diem for a moment.
Yes.
And the expense of you renting an apartment in Salem to be here for to perform your duties as a legislator would be expenses incurred in relation to your duties as a legislator, and therefore, absent the per diem, would clearly be an appropriate use of excess campaign contributions. ORS 171072, as you know, authorizes the payment of a per diem for each day that the legislature is in session. The purpose of the per diem is to provide for meals and lodging, that sort of thing, that you would not ordinarily incur but for the fact that the legislature is in session. However, because it is the concept of a per diem as contrasted with getting reimbursed for expenses you incur by saving receipts and submitting them, the concept of a per diem is, well, this is an amount where you don't need to save the receipts. It's going to be paid whether or not you actually incur the expenses. And that raises an interesting issue in the context of how this, an unresolved issue, in the context of how this relates to this limitation on the use of excess contribution monies. That's described actually on page 4 of the handout. If the per diem is considered a specific reimbursement for costs you incur, then because you receive that and you're essentially what's called double dipping by using the campaign contributions for this expense and then also receiving the per diem, that wouldn't be permitted. It's certainly arguable, however, because the per diem is paid whether or not you actually incur the expense, that this is in fact not a specific reimbursement. So this is one of these areas where there is a legally prudent answer to not engage in that practice, and nevertheless a strong argument that can be made that in fact you can stand up in court with a straight face and say, well, this, the per diem is not a specific reimbursement, and accordingly I can use campaign contribution monies for that purpose.
Thank you.
Mr. Jackson, just to follow up on that, my recollection in House Bill 3458 is that we specifically prohibited double dipping. Is that incorrect? It was legislation that we passed in the 2005 session, and I think you were not there with that session. I can't remember where you were.
Madam Chair, I was there in 2005, though I wasn't doing this, and I don't recall that legislation specifically. Though I've discussed this issue with Ted Rutlinger, who would have written the bill, and yes. He didn't apprise me of that.
Okay.
So
all right.
I'm thinking not.
Okay. Senator Ferriello.
It's just a detail, but I mean, if there is a tax consequence for taking the mileage while receiving for being so in that regard, there is a statutory effect on that after the amount of I can defer to
I would like clarification on what you were just talking about. So, for say those that commute from Salem to Portland and back every day, and I don't know if there was service, mileage or not. You're saying then that they cannot be reimbursed for mileage because they didn't receive. Is that?
No, you can't. You can't accept reimbursement for the tax.
This is a little bit of a complicated area, particularly because the rules are different with respect to legislators who live more than 50 miles from the capital and those who live within the 50-mile radius. If you commute from your home and you live more than 50 miles from the capital, you can receive the per diem and it is not subject to tax. If you commute from home and you are within the 50-mile radius, you can receive the per diem, but it is subject to tax. That is a unique, special, explicit rule in the Internal Revenue Code. You have to make a particular election for that to happen. If you receive mileage in addition, or any other expense, you can submit receipts and receive reimbursement for meals and the like. If you do that, you can claim as a miscellaneous deduction those items on your income tax return, but the per diem is then subject to tax. Or you cannot claim them. The miscellaneous deductions have their own, they're a bit problematic. You have to have at least 2% of your, you have to have deductions that exceed 2% of your gross income, and only amounts in excess of that can be deducted.
Thank you.
Senator Farrell. Oliver Schmidt, for a certified public accountant to do legislators' income tax.
Exactly, and that's why I have a tax accountant do my
Mr. Johnson, the bottom line is that as far as you know, there is no statutory prohibition on double dipping.
There is a prohibition on explicit double dipping.
Okay.
There is a, but on, because the per diem is paid whether or not expenses are actually incurred, then it is certainly arguable that that is not a specific reimbursement, and therefore, it's not necessarily the legally prudent approach, but it is arguable because that isn't a specific.
It would be good to have Ms. Johnson from the Legislative Salary Commission to be here to have this discussion about how confusing the issue is regarding per diem, because it clearly, we have many years of experience. You're very well versed. It's clearly confusing, and so I just want to put that out there. So, okay. All right, let's go back to other issues at the front of the memo.
Other issues.
Jump to the end.
The other issues, the other explicit prohibition on use of campaign, excess campaign contributions is to pay legal expenses. Of course, general legal expenses are personal, and accordingly that would be prohibited. Legal expenses that you, let's say you are sued and you're as a result of your status as a legislator, the expenses you incur with that would be an allowable use with some express limitations for if the legal expenses are incurred with respect to a civil or criminal proceeding arising from your duties as a candidate for public office. So, for example, a few years back, legislative leadership was sued improperly because of the litigants' claim that they hadn't adequately provided for school funding. And they were improperly named, and their expenses in getting their own names off the lawsuit would be something that would be appropriately you could use excess contributions for. However, if the proceeding was as a result of some claim that you were acting inappropriately in your position as a public official, it would not be appropriate to use excess campaign contributions to defend that. And that, too, is a murky distinction.
So let me give some other examples. One would be I need to get a stocking order from a constituent who was stocking me the legal fees incurred in that because it was with regard to my role as a legislator were appropriate. Whereas if I were to get a divorce, not saying that I am, but if I were to get a divorce, those legal fees would obviously not be appropriate. That's
right.
Pretty.
That's a clear one.
Because you were a public employee.
No. No. Okay. Other questions?
So if you have a litigation against you because they blasphemy of your opposing candidate, that would be covered. Anything.
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Mons Anderson, that's an interesting question because you wouldn't be making the statement that it would be alleged to be blasphemous if you weren't a candidate or a public official.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I understood that. Blasphemy is not covered.
Libel.
I don't think blasphemy is necessarily actionable in court. That's covered under the First Amendment.
That is correct. As an initial matter.
So it's substance. Slander and libel.
And
I don't even think that would be covered. It's not in connection with your duties as a public official that you're slandering your opponents. That might be a different issue.
So you're saying slander and libel wouldn't be covered either, possibly.
It would be very hard to. Part of the problem is that they wouldn't win on that basis because the fact that you're a public official, you can say anything and people can say anything about you, and you kind of hold yourself out there. So you don't really have a case. But to the extent you needed to respond. I don't think that would be the kind of thing that legal expenses would be prohibited from here. Well, that's the essence of it. We can go through the remainder of the document is examples where you may use campaign funds, for example. As I mentioned, your duties, your direct duties as a holder of a public office, you may make contributions to another campaign. You may make charitable contributions. You may not use it for personal use. And there are examples listed on pages 2 and 3 of that. I'd like to note one interesting one, and that is salary. You may not use excess campaign contributions for salary for yourself or any purpose that's essentially personal use. You can, if you wanted to use it to pay staff salary for your legislative staff, that would be appropriate, that would be allowed to the extent it does not exceed the market value, which is basically the LAC rate for your legislative staff. And then we already touched upon this little discussion on the last page about the double dipping issue. And again, explicit where you receive monies as reimbursement for particularly identified expenses and you use campaign contribution monies for those same expenses, that is prohibited. It's how the interaction with the per diem is complicated.
So I want to get back to candidates' use of campaign funds to defray office holder expenses. Some examples of that would include communicating with your constituents, for example, a newsletter, and that's a lawful use. I'm trying to think of some other ones at this point in time. I'm assuming if you had an expensive legislative office that your legislative reimbursement did not cover, you could use your campaign dollars for that.
Madam Chair, if it is the market rate, if it is a rate that's, the rental rate is higher than the market rate, no.
I assume, for example, for particularly for caucus leaders traveling around the state, gasoline expenses, that's a legitimate campaign expense, so it's probably not even an office holder expense.
Ms. Manager.
Thank you.
You're off the hook at this point. Thank you very much. It's very helpful. All right. Next, I've invited.
Watch out. Regarding bonuses at the end of a campaign, bonuses to staff. You say gifts, but that's to the volunteers. But if you have staff.
Madam Chair, Senator Mona Sanderson, because it's at the end of the campaign, it's certainly looks like a gift.
Because you say gift to campaign volunteers, but what about gifts to your staff?
Gifts are phenomenal.
Okay. Let me follow up and do a little more research, and I'll get back to you on that.
All right. Thank you. All right, next up, the Oregon Law Commission, Ms. Wendy Johnson, Mr. Schradel, and so far no Mr. Shetterly. Welcome. Good to see you. Thanks for joining us at the end.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel from the Oregon Law Commission. I have three handouts for you today that should be coming from the staff. But by way of background, the Oregon Law Commission was created in 1997 by the Legislative Assembly to assist the legislature in law reform and improvement. It's a nonpartisan commission. As I said, formed in 1997, so this is our 10-year anniversary, and we've just moved offices this year. We are a 13-member commission. Many of the members are appointed by groups, but others are ex officio. We have the Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, the Attorney General, two appointed by your Senate President, two appointed by the House Speaker, three members appointed by the Board of Governors, and each of the Oregon three law schools, their deans, and who am I forgetting? And the governor has a appointment as well. Justice Lindy is there for the governor's appointment. The Attorney General chaired the Law Commission's project on government ethics. As you may recall, during the 2005 session, both the legislature and the governor requested the Oregon Law Commission look at the area of government ethics and report back to the 2007 session. So government ethics was dealt with during the 2007 session. The Law Commission made many recommendations, some of which were accepted, some of which were modified, and some of them were wholesale set on the shelf. Campaign finance is one of those areas that wasn't addressed during the 2007 session, and so that's what we're here to talk about today. So I'll go over those handouts. You have a bill, House Bill 2597, it's just a four-page bill, that focused on campaign finance reform as it relates to ethics. You also have a PowerPoint, we're not going to go through a PowerPoint presentation today, but just the slides themselves. And then you have a one-page summary of House Bill 2597. As I said, the Attorney General chaired a law reform project starting at the end of 2005, all the way through the end of the year, and all the way through 2006, and even a bit into 2007. And then those recommendations were forwarded to the full commission. The work group was composed of 15 members and 12 advisors from a broad spectrum. It was a really impressive group that worked very hard, meeting once or twice a month to come up with these recommendations. Campaign finance was not the request of the legislature per se, but as it related to ethics, and let me explain how that relates. As you know, ethics, one of the primary focuses of government ethics laws is to look at what a public official should and should not receive as relates to financial gain. And the general principle in Oregon is that a public official should not receive financial gain that would not otherwise be available but for being a public official. So most of those laws that regulate that financial gain are in Chapter 244, what are known as the government ethics laws. But public officials can be influenced in another large area, which is with their campaign money. And so we did look at campaign finance laws a bit. Just, as I said, it's a small bill. It's only 4 pages. But there is an obvious overlap between ethics and campaign finance. That is, that the public official can be influenced by lobbying and campaign contributions. And if you don't restrict both of them, you'll have a large loophole. And so that is what I'm here today to talk about, is how the Law Commission would recommend making it consistent so that you're not allowing certain activity under the ethics laws, but still allowing the campaign finance laws. Phil Schradl is here today as instead of Attorney General Myers, as I said, chaired this project. Attorney General Myers actually chaired a substantive group that dealt with campaign finance. We broke the project up into procedural rules and some other substantive issues, but primarily the substantive issues were dealt with by the Attorney General. And Phil Schradl assisted with that project through the whole way, and so he's here to assist with questions as well. So with that, I would turn your attention to the PowerPoint, which is kind of big letters that everyone can follow along. I start out with a slide that says use of candidates' principal campaign committee contributions. I understand that you may use a different term. If you've been in this process a long time, some people call it a candidate committee. The statute uses both candidate committee and principal campaign committee throughout, but what this is talking about is each candidate has one principal committee or candidate committee, and then you can have multiple PACs that could be a caucus committee or some sort of a other environmental group or whatever. You can have whatever kind of PAC you want, but you're required by law to have at least one principal, not at least, but to only have one principal committee. And so the Law Commission makes recommendations with regard to principal committees as well as those other PACs. With the principal committee, the main the focus is that you should look at these committees perhaps differently than has been practiced, that contributions are held in trust and they're not a candidate's money, but they are the committee's money, whether it be a candidate committee or another type of PAC, that it's not the candidate's money, that it is it's in a trust for the use of for the nomination or election of the candidate. So it's not your personal money. That's just a way of thinking about it. That is nationally, that's how it's generally thought of. And so just to keep that in mind, that's the principle that guides these recommendations.
And Ms. Johnson, I want to clarify here. We're talking about all candidates statewide. Not just legislators, vice, for example, with Portland City Council, Salem City Council, et cetera, anybody would have a campaign committee. I'm assuming that the judicial code kind of overlays the judicial campaign committees a little differently, but I don't know that. So.
I'm Chair Brown, members of the committee. Yes, that's correct. You're required to have a principal committee for any election, and that's with the Secretary of State, those rules and regulations regarding reporting and how those contributions are tracked and what those contributions can be, and the filing, et cetera, all are done through the Secretary of State's office and regulations. So that's an important thing to keep in mind, that we're not talking just about legislators here, we're talking about other officials, that the present rules apply to all candidates the same. And so some of these, for example, everything that's in italics print throughout this document would be a change in the law. So presently, contributions may be used to support the nomination or election. We would suggest that you could also make it clear in statute that you could use contributions to purchase campaign treasurer-related insurance. So that's the issue of a treasurer making a mistake, not filing it properly, or not getting something timely filed to the Secretary of State, that you could have insurance to take care of those funds. We would put in statutes that you can clearly use contributions to pay for Secretary of State imposed fines, as long as they're civil and as long as they're not that diversion of personal use, basically. That's the theft issue. So that's why it's the most qualification there. But turning to the next page, the big change that the Law Commission would recommend would be to no longer allow principal campaign committees to use transfer contributions to other candidates or political committees. Again, this is focused only on your principal committee, that a donor who gives to that committee is giving it to the election or nomination of that person, that candidate, and so it should not be transferred to another. If you had a different type of PAC that the donor is on notice to, those could be contributed, those would still be allowed to transfer. The Law Commission's recommendation is that this is not the candidate's money, but it is the election or nomination of that candidate, and so therefore it doesn't, policy-wise, make sense to allow transfers for that principal candidate.
In a practical sense, is that just simply the naming of the committee? For instance, if you have a committee that is a committee to elect legislator X, then you're suggesting that the donors are on notice that that money is only for the purpose of electing that person. But if the name of the PAC is Friends of X, then that can be used for any purpose whatsoever.
Senator Farioli, Chair Brown, members of the committee. My understanding is that the name of the committee is quite flexible. It's under Secretary of State rules, but there's a designation of whether it's the principal committee or an other political committee, and so it's that designation that makes the difference. It's not the name.
The chairman just brought up the question of every single political party maintains a PAC for a variety of candidates as their principal committee. So you're suggesting that be political?
Senator Farioli, Chair Brown, no. That's a political committee. It's not a principal committee or candidate committee, as it's known for an individual. Those that are for multiple individuals are not considered a principal committee or a synonymous as candidate committee. It's a different term of art than a political committee, which would include the Democratic committee or the Republican committee. That's not considered a principal committee.
So let me give another example. So what you're talking about here with number two is banning what I would call pass-throughs from candidate committees. So, for example, Senator Johnson, because we've had so many Johnsons up this morning, Senator Johnson couldn't give to Senator Smith from her political committee. That's what you're talking about. If we establish, for example, the Independent Republican Caucus Leadership Fund, that the purpose of that is to elect a number of independents, for example, that would have a different purpose. It's not a single candidate committee.
So, Madam Chair, you just pointed the workaround, what I would call the workaround solution. It's simply to organize in the broadest possible way to avoid any of these regulations.
Senator Farioli, Chair Brown, the point is that you're required to have this one, and so people who want to give to that candidate and that candidate only may donate such. Although you're right, you can create as many other PACs as you want, but that allows the donor choices of whether they know up front that this is only going to be used for the election of this person or no, this could be used and transferred three, four, five times around the state to other candidates. It's allowing that.
I see. I sense that. I'm having a sense of pointlessness. If you can set a barrier and your purpose is to specify where the donation is made and how it's going to be used, but then you set up a parallel system that has no such restrictions, the obvious solution is to go to this second parallel system and avoid the first set of restrictions.
Chair Brown, Senator Farioli, if I might jump in, Phil Schreidel for the Special Counsel to the Attorney General for the record. I don't think it would be pointless at all for a couple of reasons. One is that as a donor, I think you're entitled to notice about what your funds will be used for. I think the current understanding right now is that if I donate for your election, I have the intent of having you elected, and that's what I intend that fund to be used for. And I may not want Senator Monis Anderson to be elected, and it's a little unfair to me as a donor to give you money not knowing that you're going to pass it on to Senator Monis Anderson for her election. Now, you could certainly avoid that by doing, if I'm a donor and I donate to, a broader entity with the understanding that that can be used that way, then I as a donor am on notice of that. The other thing that I think we're attempting to get at through the paradigm here that we're trying to establish would be that if I give money for your election, that it be used for your election and not used as a surrogate for or to avoid, you know, the gift limitations and the other limitations that the Legislative Assembly just adopted this last legislative session. I mean, it would be easy right now for me to give you money by way of a campaign contribution that is a wink and a nod to, rather than I'm going to take you out to dinner on Friday night, I'm going to give you a campaign contribution. And that's part of the paradigm that we're trying to set up, is that, you know, you have a comprehensive approach to the ethics laws that you adopted last legislative session, but there is a loophole.
Yeah, I'm sure. Could you define the term caveat emptor?
Buyer, Madam Chair, buyer beware.
That's okay. So we can build a series of lacquered boxes that nest in one inside the other, and that will not accomplish, I think, what the objective is, and what the objective, I believe, is protecting the donor from a situation where they're giving money ostensibly for one purpose that may be used for another. And isn't the real answer full disclosure? We have statutory requirements, statutory frameworks under which campaign contributions are currently usable. And it's quite clear in statute, and there are quite clear boundaries. Perhaps the answer is to make sure that this information is provided to donors so they can see what campaign contributions may and may not be used for, rather than to try to build artificial firewalls, which creativity and necessity will evolve workarounds.
I'm Chair Brown, Senator Farioli. But it strikes me that those boxes that you're talking about do serve a very legitimate purpose, that if you know as a donor that you are committing, you're contributing to a Democratic Party campaign committee or a Republican Party campaign committee, you know that those are the uses to which those funds can be put. So there's nothing in the proposal that would kind of restrict the creativity or restrict the ability to solicit those kinds of funds. It would be just setting up a mechanism so that donors could, who are interested in supporting your election, but not Senator Montes Anderson's election, to do that. And it would help in terms of avoiding the possibility that is existing under current law that would allow don't mean to pejorative with misuse, but different uses of campaign contributions from which they're no longer being used for campaign purposes, but are being used as surrogates for gifts or surrogates for office expenses. This does dovetail in with the proposal, and actually the Oregon Law Commission came forward with a non-statutory proposal to recommend that there be, you know, increased compensation for the legislators in particular. But I think you need to look at it on a broader scope, because it applies to all public officials as well. But the idea here is not to stem the flow of money that is, you know, for legitimate purposes, but it almost serves the purpose of the disclosure requirements that you're talking about, but also has the added benefit then of not allowing different uses to be put than were understood to be available at the beginning.
I think there's a lot of assumptive reasoning going on here. What's in the mind of the donor? You're making a lot of assumptions about what donors donate. And I can tell you that those are as individuals are. And I think there's a level of sophistication among many donors that realize that there's a broader political purpose in a donation than the specific election of one candidate. We are a majority rule system. And, you know, the recommendations are interesting. Thank you.
It's very hard for me. It seems like once I'm elected, I'm in campaign mode 100% of the time. And it is very, very, very difficult for me to say, this is strictly campaign and this is strictly legislative. So that's why I have a concern with wanting us to start saying campaign related, how you can use it for these things and not others, because you can really just about interpret everything that we do as campaign related.
Which really moves us to number three.
Okay.
Chairman and members of the committee, the second recommendation to not allow with principal campaign committees is to not allow those to be used to defray expenses incurred once in office. As a practical matter, as Senator Brown brought up at the beginning, campaign contributions, candidates have these monies available across the state and not just at the legislature. It seems to be that only the legislature continues to use those campaigns once in office to actually do the work of the public. And that was seen as a problem in Oregon that you don't see elsewhere. It's just, frankly, a budget issue, and that's why you see the note at the bottom, that Oregon has not provided its assembly with adequate resources to actually do its work, to do the work of the public once in office. And so we saw that as it creates great complexity, but it seems to be that if there's not enough money left in your budget, then you go back to your campaign, and it's a reality that happens that's perhaps not the best policy, and it's not done by other candidates. For example, a city council person or a school board member or whatever, a mayor, they don't go back and use that money to buy their printer for the office. I mean, it's just not done, and that is what's done in the legislative assembly to actually run their office once they're elected. Yeah. The DA, for example.
Essentially, what the Law Commission is saying is that we're using, that the legislature particularly or primarily is using campaign dollars to subsidize the cost of holding office. And the folks that should bear that burden is the general public, the taxpayers, all of us. So that's the general gist of the argument. I just want to point out there are a couple of circumstances, and I want to go back to Senator Modest and Anderson's concern, where there's some fine lines. And let me use, for example, the number of dinners and luncheons that we as legislators go to meet people, circulate, whatever. And I don't think we're the only one. In fact, I had a call from a city council candidate who does extensive amount of dinners and lunches and was very concerned. So the issue would be, I'm currently a state senator. I'm also running for another office. I go to an event because of our ethics restrictions. I can't get a free ticket to go to that event now. I wouldn't go to my campaign dollars to attend that event. I'm trying to think of something. Oregon Business Association dinner tickets are, I don't know, over $100 for the dinner. Is that something the Law Commission would say that's not an appropriate use of campaign dollars, even though I am currently an office holder and currently running for office?
Chairman, members of the committee, I think you're right. The devil is in the details. The general premise is that you should not use it doing the public's work. Those things that are campaign-related would still be allowable as a campaign expenditure, and that's the question. If it's the business committee and you need to be there for a business matter, I mean, I think the argument would be that it would be the public's work. And if you're there for campaign purposes, then it's going to be a campaign expenditure. And that can't be adequately defined, perhaps, in statute, and that's in the rules. But the present law clearly says that you can use campaign money to defray expenses once incurred in office. And the commission and the work group had absolutely no objection to saying that's not the way we should do government in Oregon. The public should be paying for the public's work.
I'd like to push back on a statement that's made. Do city councilors and other public officials PAC organize under different statutes than legislators do? Then how can you suggest that there's no use of their PACs for deferring expenses of their offices? Did you search the CNEs? Did you do a comprehensive?
Chair Brown, Senator Fairley, yes, we did. We looked at a lot of those CNEs and saw that those PACs were used, those monies were, expenditures were during the election time. They were not used once they were in office. You didn't see the postage, you didn't see the cable bills, you didn't see paper and printer costs. This just wasn't done. It was used for the election.
But it's not prohibited.
It's not prohibited, but the point is that they're not. It's just not used. It is permitted under the same, as you said, the same statute. It's just that we only saw the use of defraying expenses once in office, primarily with the legislature.
That could change, though, with the new ethics law changes, because city councilors and mayors could be going to events that they received that were comped and they didn't have to pay for. Mm-hmm. that may change with the changes in the ethics laws. But I do think there are certainly some folks that use them. I think it's generally speaking, it's the legislators who tend to use the campaign dollars during the non-campaign cycle.
Sure. Let me use a really mundane example. A first-time candidate for public office purchases a fax printer for the campaign, decides to operate that during the campaign, wins elective office, moves into an office that's paid for a public expense, but cannot take the printer with him under your rubric.
Chair Brown, Senator Fairley, that's correct. It's the campaign committee's printer.
Right. But also couldn't use the public printer for any purpose but public business that's in there.
Chairman Senator, that's correct.
Yeah. Nesting boxes. What great evil are we preventing from?
Chair Brown, Senator, I think, you know, you can tweak around the edges of those things that you still have in your committee, but the point is that it's not the candidate's money, it's the committee's money. It's for the purpose of electing, it's not for running an office later.
So campaign office furniture, campaign communications equipment, printers, faxes, computers, all locked up, useless until the next campaign.
Chair Brown said it fairly, that's the way it's written under the bill.
I'm glad we didn't pass it.
Yeah. I have a personal computer, and I only want my one little laptop. And I use it for campaign purposes. Campaign money bought it, but then I want to be able to use that because it has all of my information. It has my personal stuff, my business stuff, my legislative stuff, my campaign stuff, all on my little laptop with backup. But then I will definitely want to take that with me and use it in my legislative office. And you're saying that if campaign funds were used to buy that computer, I'd have to get another computer.
Chair Brown, maybe I can jump into the discussion here too.
I also wanted to welcome former Representative Lane Shetterly, former chair of the Oregon Law Commission.
No, I'm still chair.
Okay, good. All right, we didn't lose you.
Thank you. I apologize. You're running ahead of schedule.
We are. It's a rare thing, but it does happen.
Thank you.
So.
Just getting caught up in the conversation here. I'll let Phil go. And I want to make sure I get the context before I go. I want to see where the rocks are.
Put you right forward. The response that I was about to give was that certainly there are going to be line-drawing difficulties. There are always line-drawing difficulties for the legislative assembly. The general principle at play here is that you shouldn't have campaign monies going towards providing you with the necessary resources to do your legitimate legislative business once you're in office. There may be ways of differentiating between so that you can say that if you are using your personal computer half-time for your legislative office, that that is covered by your legislative allocation for your office expenses. Or you could have some exemptions that are carved out from that of something that is, you know, truly difficult to jointly determine how it's used jointly for things like, you know, examples that we were discussing in the Oregon Law Commission process were, well, what if you travel from Salem, let's say, to the coast, and that's a dual-purpose trip? There's a campaign fundraiser that you're attending, but there's also a constituent that you need to attend to over there. Well, can you allocate it 50-50? Maybe that's a way of approaching that. There are going to be some difficult things in line drawing, but the difficulty that we're trying to get at right now is a bigger problem that's perceived. That is that there is an awful lot of campaign money that is diverted into either transfers to other individuals or uses for which it was never intended to be used in the first place, and or for the potential for expenditures that are made by legislators or others that are either the double dipping question that Dexter Johnson was talking about before, or for that somebody who can raise more money for campaigns, should they have the ability to populate their office with luxurious furniture? Those are the kinds of things that are attempted to be getting at here. Not that it's easy, but that there will need to be some line drawn along the way.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Farrell.
Over 200 Oregonians have resigned public office from some of the work that we've done, arguably the good work that we did with Senate Bill 12. I'm just suggesting that we can. Excuse me.
And House Bill 2595.
Yeah. And perhaps what we're doing is simply overreacting. You don't live in a perfect world. And if there is a lesson here, for me, it's listening to people who believe they can extrapolate what's in the minds of other people. You know, you use the term the donor intended. Well, maybe we should work on the education of donors about what's legal and what's in the statute, rather than assuming what's in their minds and what purposes for which they donate. You know, the idea is to make a series of recommendations for statutes that will magnify the complexity of reporting and possibly subject folks to prosecution and sanction doesn't necessarily get at the objective. If the objective is to educate donors that they're to all the legal purposes to which campaign funds can be put, there's a much better way to do that than starting to build more and more and more reporting requirements, factoring formulas, and firewalls. And you know, I'm in a go slow mode after the resignation of a couple of hundred unpaid city councilors, county commissioners, and planning commission members on recommendations that make reporting requirements more complex and make more information filings and more penalties incumbent on elected public officials.
Instead of Farrioli, going slow is what we're doing, and that's why we're starting this discussion in August, several months prior to the 09 legislative session. Representative Shetterly, did you want to...
Thank you. Just to comment again for the record, Lane Shetterly, and I do apologize for being late, but I congratulate you on moving ahead of schedule on your timing this morning. What I was going to offer was just that, Senator Farrioli, in response to your comment, the resignations that you have seen really have been over issues completely different than what we're talking about here. In fact, at the local level, and I can say that now because I represent two cities populated by city councils and planning commissions who are covered by the changes in the law. If anything, there is a sense at the local level of a greater disparity between what locals can do and what the legislature has left itself and other elected officials to do under these laws. And part of it is the ability to use these campaign funds. I've only half facetiously, but suggested to my city council client that what they had to do was run establish a campaign fund and start collecting. You don't do that at the local level. You generally don't run with money for city council and planning commission, but it is because there are abilities to use campaign funds that don't apply to other non-compensated volunteer officials who find themselves under the same restrictions in terms particularly of the gift limits and entertainment limits that were passed last session. The other thing I wanted to just express is it's sort of, it's a rough analogy, but it's kind of what I take my business clients through when we're setting up a corporation or a limited liability company. Part of my education to them is that once you have established this entity, that it's different from you. You don't use your limited liability company or your corporate money to buy the family groceries. You maintain a strict distinction between what that entity is and what you are outside of that entity. And that's all sorts of purposes. And what we're getting at, I think, with these recommendations, we're to begin to draw that distinction at the elected office level as well, to distinguish between what is a campaign committee that has a certain function, and that is to get a candidate elected, and then the expenses of being in office, which are which are directed at the serving in that elected office. To the extent that we continue to use campaign contributions for those office expenses, I think one of the things we do is a disservice is to understate the compensation that elected officials are entitled to, should be paid. They have these funds available to them, and I think it undermines, in the public's mind, and the ability to make the case that we should be paying public officials, elected officials, fair compensation and provide them with fair expense accounts for the work that they do, so they don't have to use campaign funds. So honestly, there's, to one extent, to be able to draw this distinction, I think would help to make the case for better compensation and for more realistic expense accounts for elected officials to be able to use when they're in office.
So, Chair Shetterly, just to kind of follow up on your question, your comments regarding the local cities that you're representing, and their frustration is that because of the changes in the ethics code, they simply will not have access to the events that we as legislators can attend by virtue of the use of our campaign dollars, because they don't normally raise significant amounts of dollars to run for office.
They're
Portland probably being an exception.
Madam Chair, you're right. There will be local governments with that kind of candidates who do raise money, but for the most part, they don't. And that is one of the frustrations that a city council member knows now very well from the media and the education that's come down, the limitations on gifts and entertainment that apply to them. And they also know very well that if they have a campaign account, they can, in lieu of having that paid for by somebody, that they could receive a contribution to their campaign account and use that money then to pay their own way. And I think that's perceived as a real different standard between what applies to local officials and what applies to state officials.
That, there is no different standard. You're discussing custom and culture. The custom and culture of city councilors and other elected officials has been not to form a PAC. Nothing prohibits them from performing a PAC, from forming a PAC, and being subject to exactly the same statutory requirements as every other entity that has a PAC. So please don't say they're prohibited. They are not prohibited. They are under exactly the same rubric and statutes that every other citizen of Oregon has, or other, every other entity. And perhaps your advice, if it's being given facetiously, should be given in earnest.
Senator Fairley-Oley, first of all, yes, city councilors could form PACs to run for office. I think most of them won't. I think at the local level, that, especially now in light of the gift limitations, that to do that would probably not be received well. So politically, there's a disincentive to do that. Secondly, planning commissioners, who are also subject to these, they're not elected. They can't form a PAC, and neither can school teachers, volunteer firefighters, and everybody else, and thousands of state officials who come under the gift limitation. They are prohibited. They cannot do that. There's a very small group of city councilors and county commissioners who are elected who could do that. But there are tens of thousands of more who actually cannot.
Well, I think what you're arguing for is some form of non-taxable compensation for volunteers. You know, we are in a conundrum at the present moment because volunteers who have been compensated are now subject to withholding, and therefore they are resigning in mass as well. And organizations like Ski Patrol, that provide lift tickets, are now in trouble with the Bureau of Labor and Industries. And so what you're arguing for, I think, is the ability to compensate volunteers or to reimburse their expenses, reasonable expenses related to their functioning, which probably would be a more productive solution to work on than this idea of mass prohibitions, because there's some disparity between elected public officials and other public officials.
Just a brief response, and then we can move on. But that volunteer issue is there, and I know the Mount Bachelor case, I think it was.
And every volunteer fire department that provides a pair of turnouts. Right.
But volunteers aside, you still have. I mean, remember, these gift limits, public official under the law applies to school teachers. It applies to every public works official at City Hall. It applies to groundskeepers at the municipal golf course. Those folks, of course, are being compensated, but that's not going to solve the perception of disparity.
Oh, Manager. Perhaps we cast our net a little too widely if we capture 200,000 people as public officials, and maybe we ought to work on that part of the equation.
Senator, fairly early, it's like a balloon. There are different ways to squeeze it. I think that's absolutely true. Frankly, another reason this has come to the floor is because of the extent to which the legislation has tamped down on gifts and entertainment to the point of absolute prohibition. And they, if you, you know, under the old law, I think this is much less an issue because there was a there was room there that accommodated some reasonable practices at the local level that were generally not in excess of the limits that that were in place. Having gone to that, the very low limits, the absolute prohibition on entertainment, that has really brought to graphic relief this difference. Now, you're right. Under the prior system, and I think if I may say, under the recommendations of the law commission that did not go down to zero, I don't think it would have brought out this difference as graphically as it has been brought out now.
And I just want to point out that we did not change the definition of public official.
No, did not.
In the legislation, it's the same definition that is currently being used. Certainly, room for exploration. And I think you're actually sitting on the Senate Rules Committee and can participate in that conversation. So, but that's an interesting point. And my specific recollection of the Law Commission recommendations is, in terms of the GIF limit, it kind of almost went in the other direction, or at least there was more room. But that's an interesting analysis of why that's had such a huge impact at the local level and why we're seeing disparities at this point in time.
Madam Chair, I think it's a very major reason for that, the dis-ease at the local level.
That's really helpful. Thank you. Okay, let's keep moving through. I don't know how...
dis-ease, Madam Chairman, and self-inflicted.
Not by the locals.
The Public Commission on the Legislature is also going to testify as well, so keep that in mind. So you might want to save some of your comments for them and not grill the Law Commission so heavily, but maybe you do. I don't know. So anyway, keep going.
Chair Brown and members of the committee, I did want to respond to Senator Verrilli's question regarding the donor's choice again. I think the other fact of the matter is that donors don't have a choice to give to the candidate so that it will only go to the candidate, and this provides a choice. There is no way to say I'm only going to give to Senator Verrilli's committee and it won't go somewhere else. This provides a choice, not just notice, but a choice. That I think donors are very sophisticated and know that if I give the Republican Caucus Committee, it will go all over. But they don't even have a choice to get it to go to one place. It's not that they don't know that it can be transferred, but they don't have that opportunity.
And this is a perfect example of evil being in the eye of the beholder. Donors do have a choice. They have the ultimate choice. They can donate or they can not donate. And if there is a question about the ultimate purpose to which those funds can be put, the statutes are clear. And perhaps the solution to the problem is simply to make sure that when a donation check is solicited, the limitations that are in statute currently are conveyed. And, that could be printed on the same card that we require to be returned from the donor that has their occupation and their address and the other pertinent information that's required to be reported on the CNE form. So, if you're looking for a solution, there's a solution out there. If you're looking to, what was the term that you used? Dis-ease.
Yeah.
The process, proceed.
We'll agree or disagree on that point, but the point really was that there is no choice for a donor to be restricted, and they know that's the point. Moving on, there is a big note at the bottom. It does say an additional recommendation to increase the assembly's budget. I do want to highlight that we looked a lot at the legislature's own rules and statutes, and it's very complicated. We did recommend that you wholesale look at that. It would seem to take an accountant just to figure out which accounts you have, at $200 here and $400 here, and you can use this for legislative aides, but you can't use this one. And it's very complex. It makes it very difficult to do your job and to try to figure out how many computers you're allowed. It's just policy that, 2 years ago you were issued a new computer, but you can't get another one for we're not sure when. And it's just very complicated to frankly do your job. You don't have adequate office expenses accounts and for staffing. It's very complicated, and it's ever changing, the dollar amount and when you have to file and what you have to get approval of and what you don't. Perhaps the whole thing needs to be looked at, but we acknowledge that goes along with the recommendation on number three to eliminate the defraying of office expenses, that you do need to look at for the legislature how you handle your expenses.
Because, John, because of the research you did on this issue, has that been transferred to the Public Officials Compensation Commission?
Chair Brown, members of the committee, no, it is not. It has been requested that. It is part of the public record,
okay.
And it was submitted to Mr. Bacobia, a lot of those issues. I did, when I provided it to him, I did put it with a caveat that it was 2005 and 2006 data. Some of those numbers have a cost of living and such, but it's incredibly complicated.
Well, Ms. Doris Johnson was very clear that she needed more, that more information would be useful to them, since the Law Commission did the research. If that's available, it might be a good amount of information to provide them. Okay, let's keep going.
You'll see on the next slide is campaign contributions of other political committees. They're the exact same recommendations, except that you don't see them may not be with the transfers. The transfers would still be allowed for a general political committee that's not a candidate specific. And then the question is, well, what do you do with leftover campaign contributions with these candidate specific principal committees? If you can't transfer it like it's done presently, the Law Commission's recommendation would be to seriously limit those, but you have to be, you know, discontinuing and filing your notice of discontinuing the committee. And the list here is pretty self-explanatory, but you would allow it to be given to a charity, a charitable organization as defined, I believe, by the Revenue Code, a political committee of a political party, a caucus political committee, or in the case of the legislators, it could go to the general properties and supplies stores account to address some of the concerns of the legislature, in particular, wanting to be able to give it back to the legislature. This is already a statutory account that's available. So for legislatures, that was put in at the recommendation of some of your legislative members that were on our work group. And then the last slide is on the treasurers for these principal committees. It was also highly recommended to limit those for those principal committee, otherwise known as candidate committees, the candidate not serve as treasurer. Two exceptions would be if the contributions and expenditures are less than $2,000 or they're funded solely by their own personal funds. Under present law, the candidate can serve as their own treasurer, and that has led to some problems. We did discuss, this is probably, of all the recommendations, they were pretty much unanimous, with the exception of this treasurer one, and that was because some folks felt that it would be difficult to recruit a treasurer. But the overwhelming support was to require this, knowing that it may be a burden to some, but it was considered important enough that it should be limited, that you should not be able to serve as your own treasurer or candidate.
Comment on that.
Sarah Moe, Sarah.
I'm one of those that I am the treasurer of my campaign, but I have a staff person who's absolutely wonderful, who will never want to be. She says, Lori, I will do your work. And she's been with me since 2000. And she is awesome. She does everything, but she is unwilling to put her name down as treasurer because I'm the one who will take the flak. But I trust her explicitly. She is just wonderful. So it's very hard for some of us, and I may be very, very in the minority, who would be hard-pressed then, because she's giving me a steal regarding what I pay her, regarding what I would have to pay someone else.
Madam Chair, Senator Martin, I think that's why this is... this part would not be unanimous, part of the recommendation. Concern about that. You know, how to resolve it, but
right.
It's a real concern.
And Chair Brown, Senator Amanis, and Mayor Anderson, the two ways to help ease that problem, you'll see at the beginning, I mentioned that you can use your campaign monies to purchase campaign treasurer-related insurance, and you also have the legal expense fund, and you can use campaign monies for Secretary of State fines, as long as they're not of the criminal variety. So that helped ease the folks on the work group, that they knew that they would be able to tell their treasurers, look, we'll be able to defend you, we'll be able to assist with the fines, that it won't be, you know, you are on the hook for those fines, but you could also use campaign funds for those fines.
So, Chair Shadley, I just want to throw the question I asked to both Mr. Schradl and Ms. Johnson at the outset, and that was the issue of I'm currently a legislator and also a candidate. I attend a lot of functions because of the gift restrictions, I can no longer get compensated to those functions. Do you think that's an appropriate use of campaign dollars, and I'm looking out for the next few years, not right now? For example, the Oregon Business Association dinner.
Use of campaign funds to attend that dinner? What did they say?
I said you might have to allocate.
Okay. Yeah, that's I guess in especially during during the campaign season, I guess there would be a factual question as to
where,
yeah, that's a campaign event.
Some legislators, Senator Monta Sanderson maybe being one of them, are essentially always running for office. And clearly now it's we've got an election cycle that makes it pretty easy. Okay, good. That makes me feel better.
Yeah, yeah. There's not an answer to that.
Answer. I've been not hearing an answer.
No. I think you. Did we get to the details on that recommendation? we did in the legislation.
No.
It's a good question. It doesn't mean there's not an answer. I mean, I could ask you questions about the black letter of Senate Bill 10, and we'd have the same kind of frozen faces around the room in terms of what the answer is. So that doesn't mean that it's insoluble or that that it's facetious. That just means it's not easy.
And Chair Brown, I think I'd answered that question in conversation with Senator Monta Sanderson that you might have to allocate. It might be a 50-50 proposition that half of that trip or half of that event.
And so you report half of that on your C&Es and half of that where?
I think you'd have to, I think it would be an expense. You know, it's an expense.
And where would you report it?
Well, I think with the Government Ethics Commission, I think you need to file your C&Es and E's. Contributions and expenses.
Yeah. I'm about the rest of my case. But increasing the complexity is not going to increase the protection for citizens.
But Chair
Brown, and what you're suggesting is increasing the complexity.
Look, Chair Brown,
let me.
Wait. We're not arguing here. Why don't you finish your question, Sir Ferriola, and
right,
I'll let Mr. Schradl respond.
Thank you.
Fully and completely.
Relative to the example that Senator Brown used with the annual dinner. If she goes as an individual, she can't use campaign funds because it's personal use. If she goes as an elected public official under current law, she can use campaign funds because it's related to her role as an elected public official. Under the rubric that you're suggesting, she can't use campaign funds under any circumstances and therefore must use personal funds to go, even though it might be construed, as in Senator Monta Sanderson's case, but it's a political appearance where she'll network for political purposes, particularly if she's a statewide candidate. So which is it?
First of all, I think it's not clear that she couldn't use campaign funds, that you couldn't use campaign funds if the purpose for the appearance of the event is campaign-related. If you're there as part of your candidacy, then I think it's not clear that you couldn't use campaign funds. That's where I think in Phil's comment, it gets back to the allocation and the purpose for it as to how you declare it.
Except that under your recommendations, then if this is an expense of a public official and she's appearing as a public official, that would be prohibited that in your recommendations.
Well, unfortunately, the example I use is pretty clear because I'm also a candidate at this point in time, and I can make a pretty good argument that appearances I would make at this point in time are for the purpose of my election. I think when it gets murkier is the situation like Senator Monta Sanderson or folks that are, for all intents and purposes, running for office all the time.
Well, I can have a midterm.
Midterm? Well, midterm. Are you running for office midterm?
I with Senator Monta Sanderson, virtually every appearance I make is related to outreach for the purposes of campaign.
Chair Brown, the comment that I wanted to throw into the mix before was the complexity already exists. I mean, the conversation that we were having earlier with Mr. Johnson shows that there are incredibly complex lines that you need to draw right now. The fact that those might remain
I don't think should stand in the way of dealing with the principal and the philosophical issue at issue here. There are always going to be those murky areas on the edges and those difficult ones to how you allocate if it's a dual purpose or all those kinds of things. Those exist now. I don't think the world would be more complex. It might not be less complex, but it might be better serving some principles for the law commission.
Where and so I disagree. I think what I see here is an increase in complexity, an increase in prohibition, and there will be an increase in adaptive behaviors or predictable result. I think disclosure to donors about legal purposes to which campaign funds solves the problem.
But Senator Ferriol, with all due respect, and one of the reasons why I'm having this hearing today is that the argument that Chair Shetterly laid out so very clearly, and that is, for all intents and purposes, we are using candidate campaign dollars to subsidize the cost of our doing office. And if we want to be treated with respect in terms of the compensation package, then we are going to have to. You can't get it all. Is all I'm saying. And at some point, you're going to have to make some choices. And if folks choose to use their campaign dollars as a way of subsidizing the office holder's expense, that's a totally legitimate expense choice to make. But I don't think then we can have the expectation that we have a salary, justifying the duties of the office and full-time compensation. I don't think you get both in this world anymore. I could be wrong, but I don't think you do.
I'm sure I understand exactly what you're saying, but what I hear in advocacy is what's called the train wreck theory. You make a big enough train wreck and somebody will come along and recognize the problem and try to fix it. My experience with the train wreck theory is all you get is the train wreck.
If I can, just to go back to an earlier point that I made, one of the reasons for an OBA dinner is a good example. Again, one of the reasons that is a particular problem now is the ratcheting down of the gift and entertainment limits that say that you can't do that on a comped basis. If we hadn't gone down to that level, then you wouldn't be worried about that level of complexity here. And most of the things that people do on a day-to-day basis could be accommodated within a reasonable gift and entertainment limit that wouldn't raise these issues.
And Senator Ferriol's frustration is that he did not support the ramping down of those gift limits. And so that argument probably is.
So I'm feeding him. Well, that's right. We agree.
Actually, Madam Chair, I was just about to pounce on that comment.
I know.
Thank you very much. You saw me move.
Yeah.
I knew exactly what you were going to do.
The comment that I wrote down when you were dithering earlier.
Thank you.
It was about our abandonment of reasonable practices. We have abandoned reasonable practices, and that's why we're having these problems.
And that certainly, Senator Ferrioli, you are entitled to your perspective. I think there are members of the public, there are certainly members of editorial boards around the state, and certainly the law commission that would disagree with that. And certainly, I think it's fair to say, I mean, in terms of our ethics stuff, I mean, they were very complex to begin with. Certainly, clearly, people had a hard time complying with them. And the fact that we made changes has certainly raised the level of attention to the ethics laws themselves. But also, we have ramped down. I don't think there's any question about that. But I think, I hate to say this, and maybe you're not disagree, but I think taxpayers have a different expectation out of public officials in 2007 and 2008 than they did in 1973 when our ethics laws were passed. And certainly over the years, I think people's expectations have changed, and I think it is incumbent upon us to enhance or whatever, restrict, whatever word you want to use, so that our ethics both on the campaign side and on the legislative side are able to withstand public scrutiny. So.
And Chairman, I agree with that comment with the caveat that I think all have to reluctantly or enthusiastically admit that there never was a perfect piece of legislation. And the question is whether or not we have the courage to make course corrections when we've obviously gone too far.
And that's why I'm having this hearing in August, so that by January or February there will be a consensus among legislators about the direction that folks feel comfortable with about imposing in terms of further limitations on the use of campaign dollars.
Madam Chair, if I may, I know you need to get on, but just to insert myself into that conversation, Again, if you look back at the Law Commission's package, what it did was this ratcheting down of the use of campaign funds, but it also did not make the corresponding changes the legislature did in the gift and entertainment limits. I think there's a balance in there that if you're going to restrict or prohibit the use of campaign funds but still maintain the ability to accept reasonable gifts of entertainment and meals, then I think there's a path there by which that both interests can be accommodated. So I would just offer that that again was really the balance that the Law Commission's initial legislation struck.
Very well. Thank you. Any more questions for the Law Commission folks?
No, but just to say that full disclosure, I think, is more meaningful to the public because, and rather than putting limitations, you know, I'm more in favor of the full disclosure, which, at least when I'm talking to people, they say, as long as I know how you're spending your money, that's the
point. And Madam Chair, Senator Monica Anderson, reporting also was enhanced in the Law Commission recommendation.
And that's one of the issues, frankly, was that we ramped down on limitations,
yeah.
But also increased
yeah.
the reporting.
That's true.
So that sort of
adds.
Yes, exactly. So thank you
thank
all
you.
Very
Pleasure
much. Appreciate your time and energy. All right, next up, now that we've thoroughly grilled the Law Commission, let's invite up Kim Duncan. She's a former Public Commission on the Legislature member, as well as Hans Lindy, Professor Lindy from Willamette University, also a member, and I think you have drift of some of the concerns that we have at this point in time. But we know you're both very skilled in the ways of the legislative process.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. What you have just been discussing.
And your name for the record.
Excuse me, I'm Kim Duncan. I'm former member of the Public Commission on the Legislature, and I've watched this process for 40 years in different capacities. So coming back and hearing this debate, it always does seem to come between how far can you go and overcomplicate for those people that are affected, legislators, other public officials, versus the public interest and what needs to happen. I think I might better comment not on the specifics in the legislation that the Public Commission on the Legislature produced, because they're almost identical to what you were just discussing in terms of the restriction of campaign funds, but instead to talk to you a little bit about the purpose and the context and the intent of what the Public Commission was trying to do. When the Commission was formed, it really had a unique opportunity to look holistically at what was going on in the legislature. And when it did that, it identified significant problems. And that's the word that was used. And I think it's important for you to hear that. Not insignificant problems, but significant problems. Including a loss of public confidence in what the legislature is doing. In addition, a reduction of independence because of the use of the initiative, increasing complexity of all of the funding issues that you face, excessive partisanship, escalating costs of campaigning, declines of citizen legislature, and, of course, the need to operate professionally in the 21st century as an institution. Those were significant enough issues that the commission tried to address them and then come back with a set of recommendations that they wanted the legislature to view as a whole, not to cherry pick them, because then you lose the impact of what you've just done. And you know, organizations like the legislature don't do this kind of mega audit very often. So you get you know, a shot and maybe a second shot at it, but it doesn't work unless these things come together as a package, and that's what the Public Commission tried to give you. I would also like to commend you for even creating this commission. It was really an exceptional group of people, incredible quality of debate, quality of intellectual arguments that came before us, and a real understanding, I think, of what the job is that you do, and then, of course, what's going on in the public. It was a very, I felt privileged to be a participant, and I think all the other members did as well. Ideas were abundant, and you can see, I know that you all enjoyed reading this report. But I recommend it to you again for a little bit of time reading if you get bored sometime. It actually reads quickly and pretty coherently. It's not a plotting document. There were a ton of ideas, and ideas are always what you get in a thing like this. You get more ideas than you know what to do with. We parsed it down to a set of recommendations aimed at making the legislature more efficient, more effective, but also to find handholds to rebuild public trust. Now, there's a lot of chicken and egg about if you're more efficient and effective, does public trust follow, or can you create signals to rebuild public trust that allow you to be more efficient and more effective? We decided that that wasn't the way to go about this. You needed a whole package, and you needed to have appropriate salaries. You needed to have sufficient staffing and professional support. You needed to have decent office space and equipment to work with so that you could be efficient. But you also needed to deal with some of the campaign and ethics-related issues that seem so troublesome, real or perceived, in the minds of the public. And as a result, a bill to restrict the use of campaign funds that you just discussed was presented. But it was linked to salary. And it basically said, much as you've just discussed, if the legislature is appropriately compensated, if the legislature has the kind of staff it needs, if the legislature, frankly, meets often enough, the annual session recommendation, then you have more ability to deal with your campaign funds in a more transparent manner. And that's what the commission felt was important to the public. Transparency, first, and then some level of insulation from what's perceived, you know, special interest impacts on what goes on in Salem. Well, what you didn't get at during the last session that I think could help this discussion was another recommendation from the Public Commission. And that was to create, I don't know, Public Commission too, but we were really calling it a commission on campaign finance reform. And we'd hoped that that would have come out of the 07 session. It didn't, but that you would have had some interim work by a group of elected officials and members of the public that would begin to grapple with all of these issues you discussed. There's nothing simple about it. We all know that. But there is a way to tell the public that it's important to the legislature because it's important to the public. And you do that by creating a product, by creating work, by creating forums that this kind of a commission could do. So, and it could take under advisement the very issues you were talking about here. I know you've all heard this 100 times. There's nothing new under the sun about this. But I would urge you to reconsider creating such a commission so that you could begin to get at these issues with structure, with a bipartisan group, with appropriate amount of public input, and say to the public, at the same time that we are improving our ability to act professionally because we are improving our facilities, because we are improving our staffing, our salaries, we're doing these other things as well. And you get not only credibility, but you get yourself into a situation where you can more ably deal with the really critical issues that are in front of you. I mean, the substantive issues, the education issues. the economic issues, the climate change issues that you face, you've got to be able to get to those and get beyond some of these things that hold you back. So that was what the Public Commission wanted to do by creating a secondary committee on campaign finance reform, and that's where I would encourage you to go.
Professor Lindy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senators, I've heard this debate so interesting, and you've had touch on almost everything that I think I'm sort of anticlimactic at this point. It's, I don't want to repeat what's been said. But I was a member, I'm Hans Lindy, and I was a member of both of these bodies, both the Law Commission Committee and also the Commission on the Legislature. So I'm the only person who was on both. And we start really with an important premise that goes back by now 50 or 60 years since television became the main medium. The campaign financing and the way we handle campaign money is the biggest single recognized, everybody would say it's the biggest issue about politics in the whole country. My experience goes back to the campaign, you won't believe this, 1954 for Richard Neuberger. Richard Neuberger was the state senator who was elected to the U.S. Senate. And he came to Washington and said, we've got to do something about campaign financing. So first I want to join in the recommendation on the commission that's made by Kim strongly, and that is, do create a commission on campaign financing. Now, I don't believe you need to make today's topic a necessary portion of that. You don't have to rehash this again and again. But I do want to give you a little different legal perspective from what you've been hearing up to now. And I mean something very simple. The point was made both by Phil and by Wendy to understand that campaign money never is the candidate's money. It's the committee's money. Everybody, including your counsel, and including even Wendy herself, for convenience, starts using the words, well, you can do this, and you can do that, and you can do that. Legally, that's not so. Legally, the committee can do this. And you say committee. From the standpoint of elected officials, the committee is a necessary bureaucratic technicality, and we kind of pretend that we go through this. But, in fact, and the same thing with the treasurer. So the answer to a number of these questions that you've been asking is not, is this legal, is that legal, may I do this, may I do that. The simple answer to that question is, if you want to determine whether it is a legitimate campaign, or a proper, let's put that word in there, an appropriate campaign expenditure or not, is to say, ask the treasurer. It's their job. They're the trustees for that money. You're not the trustees for that money. Just ask. Say, that's what I've got a treasurer for. If they say it's all right, fine. You may say this is politically utterly unrealistic. That's not how the practice really works. If that is not what you intend, then you need to change the entire structure of this money. Legally, that's the answer. So the idea that something that you can shift money to another campaign, for example, was pointed out to you twice today already, that money given for one particular campaign is as much a fiduciary duty of that treasurer, is not, even if you decide you want to do it, is not to release that money if it goes to another person's campaign. That's the legal answer. Pass-throughs are not necessarily permitted under the existing law, but you're thinking only about the statute. Now, if you think about if a contributor says, what are you doing? I gave you $500 for your campaign, a substantial sum. I want that money to go to your campaign. Otherwise, you know, you're in trouble. You're misusing funds for that purpose. Of course that's right. all I have to say to you is, if you were to imagine somebody giving money to a university athletic department, by the time, for example, suppose you gave it in support of a university's foundation for the music program, and they gave it to the athletic department for the baseball team. You know, do you think that's legal? Their auditor, their lawyer would tell, what in the world are you doing? You can't do that. And you're in the same position. Now, realistically, if you don't think I'm being just a book lawyer about this. The examples of the misuse of campaign contributions by pastors, you know, have become famous nationally. You know that. They've been around for generations. You have Tom DeLay, you can now have Ted Stevens, the senator from Alaska. This happens continually. Yeah. I beg your pardon? What did you say, Senator Perioli?
Oh, I just muttered, Mr. Justice, innocent until proven guilty. Seems like an appropriate...
Oh, no. It's not talking about any charges against him. I'm talking about the known fact that he gave tremendous amount. He has great support, people. Look, realistically, a lot of legislators and other public officials have safe seats. It's not that they need the money just to get elected. The idea of saying, well, but I do need the money, so please contribute to my campaign so I can use it for non-campaign purposes. Or I can pass it to somebody else and I can win support and build a majority for my team in the legislature. I'll be the fundraiser for my majority. I'll ask, but okay, the activities are quite legitimate. But funding it through your individual campaign pack is not legitimate. And that's all we're saying. It's not. This isn't a change law. We're not demanding that anything be made more complex. We're just pointing out that you are operating under a system that you're not following. Because everybody thinks once, you know, the money's been given, then it comes under the control of the candidate or the elected official. That's legally not the case. If you buy that computer, you know, sure, it's the committee's computer. If they want to let you use it, fine. That's a different problem. But if you talk about large items, then you run into the difficulty that once it's turned over to you for other uses, and I think you've managed to solve some of that in this reference to the new section on personal expenditures, because then it's a gift, and then you run into the gift limitation problem. That's the way the thing is structured. If you don't like that, you don't want to just not pass an improvement. You'd have to do away with the existing law, because that's already covered under the structure of the existing statute. Now, let me talk about this transfer problem. Senator Fraioli says, well, people ought to know that this money can be passed along to somebody else. You know, I get a lot of requests to contribute to the campaign of my own legislators or something like that. I happen to be smart. I was on this commission. I've been in this watching campaign financing for 50 years. But a lot of people would be amazed if you said, well, yeah, I'm really not going to spend this for me. I'm going to collect all that money and turn it over to my people who run the campaigns for the other people in my party so we can have a majority in the legislature. That is widely known. You want to put a notice in your please contribute to my personal campaign, but you understand I can pass it along to anybody else I want to? All I can tell you is, when I once had an uncontested election campaign, we had money left over, and about one-third of the collected funds. And these were a committee composed of people like Hardy Myers and Henry Breithoff, who was my treasurer. He's now the state tax judge. Do you think they would have turned the money over to somebody else? Of course not. Nor would they say, well, why don't you spend it as part of the expenses of being a judge? That isn't how the system is supposed to work. So the problem really is, and as we point out, it's not difficult. You don't have to make it more complex. All you have to say is, okay, you want to help raise funds for other purposes, just create a separate fund. So I'm going to give you some practical suggestions. Now, the legal answer has already been pointed out to you is you can just give it to any political action committee that's not a principal campaign committee for your own campaign. No problem. You can have people contribute that in the first place. You just can't transfer it. You do get mixed up, and I must say, that ethics panel that we served on in the Law Commission heard a great deal of argument about the maximum value of gifts to an official. They're preoccupied. Why? Because that's dramatic. The media can understand it. The readers can understand it. Say, oh boy, here, yeah, this is $900 tickets to whatever the Trailblazer gave to, you know, somewhere. I'm not talking about those. That's not something that I think deserves the attention it gets, but it gets the attention, and so that's what you people hear about, and that's what you feel you have to deal with. But we've also had experienced lobbyists tell us, it doesn't matter what you want to give somebody, you want to help somebody, you say, well, you pay the bill, and I can give you a campaign contribution, and until you closed up the personal gift thing in the recent statute, that was just regardless okay. Now, there's no question about it. That service in a part-time, unpaid position carries costs for the individual. That should not prevent anyone from seeking or serving in public office. And of course, higher salaries and office funds will help. We also should recognize, however, that neither higher pay nor ethics regulations will level the playing field between officials with and those without continuing outside income or independent wealth. You might compare, and at least again, historical examples, you can compare a senator like Jack Kennedy, who could afford to have a second office downtown, not connected to the U.S. Senate, and staff and whatever, because he didn't have to raise money for it, with an impecunious one like Richard Nixon, whose political supporters, as I recall, paid for much the same thing, and who then had to make his famous checkers appeal in order to be allowed to stay on the presidential ticket with Dwight Eisenhower in the 1952 election. I don't think the legislature should continue to tolerate a system that is based on pretense and hypocrisy. If you allow private groups to pay all a legislator's expenses, this should be done openly. Not disguised as an election cost. If so, you could allow a separate fund for that purpose with a separate treasurer, not the campaign treasurer. And full transparency, which is what you favor, as we recommended and the legislature adopted for legal defense funds. You've already done this as a way to pay for legal defense in allegations of unethical conduct and so on. I believe the governor's mansion was another example, using a foundation to create an asset that's necessary or desirable. And so are the foundations that support many salaries and expenses at Oregon's academic institutions. The mechanisms are there. Whether you politically think this is what you want to do, of course, is your business, not mine. But in any event, the need to meet the expenses of public service does not justify the pretense of collecting so-called campaign contributions that the campaign will not need and will not spend for the campaign. Ending these misuses of individual campaign funds is something legislators need to change now without waiting, you know, for commission. All right? That's the end of my testimony.
If there was a candidate out there that was sort of a like mind, we all don't have like minds, but I would know would help get my agenda through. I feel it puts a damper on me by not being able to help that candidate.
You may help that candidate.
With campaign funds.
Not your campaign funds, you can't. You can certainly spend your own money.
But see,
why, that money isn't your money. That's my whole point.
But it would help me as a candidate also.
How?
In the legislature.
Well, no, not as a candidate. It might help you later on in achieving your agenda, but it doesn't help you as a candidate.
Well, it's very hard for me to separate the two.
Why?
You are campaigning when you're in the legislature. And you're saying...
No. You're not talking about... I'm not talking about your campaigning, and you're saying I would be a more effective legislator if I elect some buddies to the legislature who will help me. Why? That is not part of your campaign. That may make you a more effective legislator. It certainly doesn't have anything to do with whether you get elected or not. And that money...
But
why is it so important to legislators to be able to collect their principal campaign funds, their campaigns, set up a committee that's supposed to be in charge of managing that? This is the committee's money. The bank account is the committee's bank account. It's not your bank account. The treasurer is the committee's treasurer. You speak of my treasurer. No, it's not your treasurer.
Hesitate to engage this gentleman.
You should.
I do. I go here with great trepidation. Relative to Senator Minas Anderson's comments, the presidency of the Senate is an elective office. And there is a campaign for that elective office, and it happens after the election is held in among the general electorate. It is a campaign that's mounted for a total of 30 votes. Similarly, the Speaker of the House is elected, and so are the majority leaders and minority leaders. And those campaigns are just as hotly contested and may, in fact, depend on exactly what.
Yes.
And the race may not always go to the highest and best qualified individual, but perhaps the most politically effective.
Of course.
And so I just ask how that fits into the context, or how that context fits.
I understand that. But, you know, when the statute speaks of campaigning in elections, it doesn't include those as... in the definition. If you want to change the statute, and you say, well, you can also separately, a campaign can also be a campaign that is directed only at your colleagues in the legislature and not at the public, you better say that. That is not what the statute says today. I'm giving you a legal answer. Whether as a policy matter you think that's a good idea, that's up to you. But as a legal matter, no, you cannot say, well, I'm spending this money in part so I can help gain votes for a different election that isn't part of the election on the ballot.
Okay, I guess my point is that we can continue to replicate the requirements and the statutory networks.
Jennifer Yoli, I'll tell you.
As we can find new situations where they apply. And that will make a more complex system, not a more simple system. I think in our discourse I hear, at least I've heard you acknowledge that I favor a better informed and more knowledgeable contributor.
I've heard that.
And I believe what would happen if we clearly explained to donors what
Mr. Johnson, our legal counsel, legislative counsel, has captured in a very concise four-page document that that would truly empower donors to make a choice to donate or not to donate, knowing the statutory framework within which they're donating. And rather than, I mean, this already exists in the statute, and rather than replicating a situation where a presidential hopeful in the Senate would have to create some sort of a mechanism if they wished to donate to senatorial candidates who may later support them in their campaign, this seems to me to be replication without purpose. When, in fact, any donations that the presidential hopeful makes is already reported on our CNE system. And it's transparent.
No, wait.
And people can
no.
see those transfers.
No. Just let's separate two points here. One is there was a time when we didn't have any of these statutes. And then you had a minimum of complication and boxes and concerns about following the rules. You want to go back to that? That's a policy choice. I'm telling you, the present statute already doesn't allow some of the things and the common law of trusts, fiduciary obligations, kick in whether or not the statute refers to it. That's simply something between the donor and the committee violating a fiduciary duty if you spend that money on something that was for which it wasn't given. Like my example about giving something to a trust or foundation or art museum which gives it instead to the symphony. I mean, you can't do that. So, I'm not arguing policy here with it. I'm saying, you want to do away with the whole system, fine. That's your business. If you think after the fact reporting creates transparency, no, it doesn't help the donor. The people who get these invitations to give money, unless you tell them at the time you ask for the money, now you understand I can use it. If you wanted to create a mechanism for doing that, I would say it would be simpler.
Yes.
No, wait a minute. As the sentence goes, it would be simpler to do away with the need for a principal campaign committee.
Yes.
That would be the simpler way to do it. But to say, yes, we've got to have a principal campaign committee, it's for your campaign. However, we will tell somebody at the time you go to the fundraising party here at somebody's house and somebody's there collecting checks, and you have what, little slips you're going to tell people, please be informed that this isn't necessarily for this candidate. This candidate may win anyway and have a few tens of thousands of dollars they've collected, not to mention hundreds of thousands of dollars and collected to advance in the leadership positions. You want to put that all down in a slip of paper and give it to them?
Justice Lindy, I think it would be simpler to provide them with the current legal purposes to which campaign contributions can be.
Not the way they're written now.
Well, I don't know if you have this memo in your possession.
No, I do not. I do not, but I'm talking about how
this is
written now.
An informed donor has a choice, and I agree with you that informing them before they write their
check
is much better than creating outright prohibitions that people eventually will find a way to work around.
My point is that there's always a tremendous temptation, not just in legislature, elsewhere, to have rules on paper that satisfy certain desires for ethical behavior. And a practice which departs from that. And then the question is, do you want to have that kind of pretense and hypocritical relationship between the two? I think it should not be that way. And I think that if ever somebody asks for the Attorney General's opinion, or, I mean, your counsel thinks only about this statute. But if somebody were to bring a declaratory judgment action, say, you know, may the president of the present system, may a treasurer give money that's given to the committee to somebody else, would the committee be in trouble if they did that? And the answer would be yes. Of course they're in trouble if they do that.
Unless they were organized as a non-principal.
Of course, that's my point. You Clearly, clearly that's correct.
All right, you two. I've got to... Sarah Ferrioli, let's see, one more.
It is not a question for Justice Sandler.
Okay.
Okay.
But let me go back to my major point, really. You people have operational problems living in the system you've created. I understand that. But my main point is what the commission on the legislature, as distinguished from law commission, wanted to do is to please create a commission that looks at campaign financing generally as an overall system, because it's got much more serious problems than this. Thank you.
Thank you. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you very much.
So, Madam Chairman, I do have a question.
You can ask the question, but I'm not going to let Professor Lindy answer it. We're going to ask, while you're asking the question, I'm going to have Ms. Kathy Eaton and Ms. Janice Thompson
it's
come on.
It's for Ms. Duncan.
Oh, okay. Well, then we'll let her answer.
I'll attempt to be brief.
I very much appreciate your work on PCOL. Thank you very much. And it is valuable work. You use a couple of terms in the last, second to last paragraph in the second page of your testimony, which was given to the committee, and I appreciate you not reading it. That's nice. Simply regarding the intention to reduce the influence of stakeholders and special interests. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if I could get some insight from you, who are stakeholders that you'd reduce their influence, and who are special interests whose influence you'd like to reduce?
Scott, I want to take this from what happened, Madam Chair, at the Public Commission on Legislature. There was a tremendous amount of discussion and concern. You've heard it all. There's nothing that you haven't heard about the role of special interests funding campaigns and having then a level of influence once you get to the legislature on policy matters. There was never any discussion that citizens, stakeholders, special interests don't have a right to be at the table. It's that you want to create a level of insulation between how you get elected and what issues you deal with when these important constituents are in front of you. And that was the discussion we had. What we didn't get to, because there was not enough time given everything else we were dealing with, was how you begin to address that in a transparent way so that the public has faith and confidence that the decisions that are being made in the legislature are being made based on the best public policy outcomes. That's why we recommended having a commission on campaign finance.
So that would account for the stakeholder issue, I think, but I'm more interested in what your definition of the special interest is. And I wrote down some acronyms.
Yeah.
GSA would be the Girl Scouts of America. Is that a special interest?
Could be if they were funding significantly. PETA? PETA? Senator Ferrioli, I understand the point you're making here.
Well, I'd like to go further. The two largest special interest groups that I can identify by the dollar amount of collections are Oregon Education Association and SEIU. Mm-hmm. I forget the acronym here. It's a state, what is it? SEIU. Service employees.
I was thinking the Statement of Economic Interest.
And between them, they collect something like $30 million a year. A year. And, you know, that seems to me to be a pretty significant special interest. And if you look at where the PACs are and where the contributions are, that's a tremendous amount of special interest. Is that what you're referring to?
I wasn't referring to any one individual group in particular, but you know them when you see them and you understand the impact they have on elections and on policymaking. SEIU is a large PAC, has significant role to play in what's happening in our state, but they are not alone.
they have every right to make contributions. That's not the issue. The issue is, how do you be certain that you, as legislators and members of the public, are insulated from undue influence, excess influence, when you get to making policy?
And I guess, you know, I think you put your finger right on it. It isn't a matter of being able to insulate from undue influence. It is a matter of being required to disclose where that influence is brought to bear, particularly. And I think that's what the state is.
That's right. I think the state has always been very good about emphasizing disclosure and public information from the time it began working with ethics legislation in the early 70s. It's always been an underlying principle. Adaptive behavior that you've referred to also happens, and that is what discourages the public.
All right. I don't know who wants to start. All right. Is there anybody else wishing to testify this morning? Okay. Take it away. And welcome. It's good to see you.
Good morning. It's good to see you too, Chair Brown. For the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. Senator Ferrioli, who's departed.
He'll be back.
Senator Mona Sanderson, it's good to see you too. We've been here a long time this morning, so I'm going to be quite brief. The League, as you know, is a nonpartisan political organization which encourages informed participation in government. One of our basic principles is that government needs to be accountable and transparent, and the use of campaign funds fits into that equation. We are very much interested in it. We followed with both interest and attention most of the proceedings of PCOL and the Law Commission when they were discussing ethics and the way in which ethics and campaign finance reform and the use of legislative campaign funds were being discussed. We also were present, as you know, at most of the hearings during the 2000 session, both the hearings that were held on Senate Bill 700 before Rod Monroe's committee on the Senate Committee on the Legislative Reform, as well as the Rules Committees of both the House and the Senate, discussing these particular issues. And we concurred with the support for the renewal or revision or revival of what is the Public Officials Compensation Commission, because we feel that that's a very important piece of the whole discussion about the use of candidate expense and candidates' campaign funds. We heard extensive information from elected officials about the difficulty, particularly in the interim, of doing their legislative work and what their constituents expect, and the fact that they don't have any money, very much money, to be able to do that, because you get a salary during the legislative session that includes per diem and those kinds of things. But when you're on the road, particularly in the rural areas, but also urban areas have floods, you need sufficient funds to be able to do the work of legislators. So we felt that the piece that has to do with adequate compensation, not only salary, but the expenses of legislators, is an extremely piece that must be considered, along with the idea of the best use of campaign funds. And as you've heard, we've all heard this morning, the difficulty with dealing with restrictions on those, how you're funded, how you can use it. So we certainly, in the interests of accountability and transparency, believe that the commission the Public Officials Compensation Commission really needs to take into consideration all of the pieces. Ms. Johnson did refer to the fact you can't do individual representatives and legislators, but there has to be a recognition of the fact that there are differences between legislators and where they come from and how they react. That needs to be taken into consideration in the comparisons with other states and with how the compensation for Oregon legislators then relates to their ability to use campaign funds and what kinds of restrictions can be put on that. So, again, in the interest of transparency and accountability, we hope that this discussion can move forward and some positive actions taken in the session.
Janice Thompson with Democracy Reform Oregon, a group focused on government accountability and increasing participation. To begin with, I think it's important to place this discussion into the context of these related conversations that have definitely come up. One is important to identify that the use of campaign funds focus of this discussion is not the same as campaign finance reform. And so there is this whole need to talk about campaign finance reform. You know, maybe the right.
Just for the record, we're at least beginning the discussion, I believe, in September.
Right, exactly. Right.
So,
you know, and that, you know, maybe a commission can help with that, maybe not, but that's definitely a big, big piece of the puzzle. The other big piece of the puzzle was dealt with in the last session with the Senate Bill 10 and the accompanying House bill. And obviously, all these pieces, you know, interact. And there's some I think that it's you know, in terms of the, so that, and that's come up here in terms of like how some of this, especially for non-legislators, some of the changes in the gift limits. The one comment I'll make on that, though I know that's primarily going to be discussed before Senator Devlin's committee, is the addition to Senate Bill 10 to have a complete limit on entertainment. It was really an 11th hour kind of addition on the House side. It was kind of when they were in work session. I actually would have testified against that. I think that just, you know, we didn't. That's not hitting quite the sweet spot. But that's going to be, we'll get into that with Senator Devlin's committee, is that they've already had a hearing, they're going to have more and all that kind of stuff. So, but I wanted to say that in terms of just how this use of campaign funds issue kind of fits as, you know, this constellation of these other complex issues with lots of moving parts. And I think one of the goals with campaign funds, and I think I used actually a graphic before your committee when it was the Rules Committee last session, was one of the goals here with regards to the use of campaign funds is to try to push the world of what somebody is doing as an elected official, as a public official, and as a candidate is as far apart as possible. But I think that, again, the discussion here and some of the questions, you know, this is really tricky. I think there are going to need to be some carve-outs and, you know, things like that.
And I'm just going to stop you right there because this sort of raises the question of Sarah Montes's Anderson computer. And what that really raises is not, you know, I guess for Professor Lindy, it's about, you know, separating the committee's assets from the public official working assets. The other problem we face is the fact that sometimes we do something that may be considered a campaign activity in the middle of the day
right.
when we're a legislator. And so
right.
the harsh reality is that there is no sort of cement wall there, and that's really the
right.
issue is that and our lives are like this.
Right. And actually, I think that setting for legislators and any elected official or public official is complicated. And to use Senator Montes Anderson's example, like on your laptop, you have your personal stuff, your business stuff, your campaign stuff, and your elected official stuff. I have a laptop. I worked out with, you know, the organization I work with, you know, how to handle that because I also have personal stuff on it. I mean, so it's not like this is completely unique. It comes up with cell phones, and, you know, when an organization is going to, you know, pay for somebody's cell phone and how much has to be reimbursed if personal... I mean, but I think in your setting, it's complicated because it's not just between, like, a work situation and a personal life. It's that plus then the campaign and personal work and then office. So it's... So I want to just really, you know, just name the complexity of this.
But I also... The fear, and I wasn't able, I didn't, the fear is to be doing campaign activity on something, there's some lines that are not okay to cross.
Right, so yeah. So if I could go through it,
okay.
No, that's fine. So I separate out this use of campaign funds discussion into four components. One is... has actually already been dealt with, and it's listed in the memo, you know, campaign funds cannot be used to pay certain legal expenses. I'm going to double-check with Gina, but I'm pretty sure what she means there are restrictions in Senate Bill 10 such that campaign funds can no longer be used to pay for ethics fines or legal fees before the Ethics Commission, which I think actually were a little stronger than what came out of the Law Commission's recommendations. And I believe in there, actually, one of the Commission's recommendations in this regard that is also in there, which is you can't use campaign funds for 260 elections-related fines related to use of personal funds. So I want to, I mean, it's been very frustrating to me in talking with reporters and others for folks on this point to not recognize that Senate Bill 10 actually dealt with the use of campaign funds topic, which was close, had the closest policy connection to the ethics big ball of wax that bill was about. So that's number one. So I just want to, like, something has already been done, in other words, and let's, you know, kind of acknowledge that along the way. The second topic relates to pass-through restrictions and or bans. And one of the things that wasn't mentioned in the earlier testimony is that legislative counsel did provide to the Law Commission kind of a due diligence letter naming that under Oregon Constitution, these restrictions are questionable legality. And in addition to, I mean, but, you know, they thought they had a way worked out that, you know, so it was, you know, sometimes it's worth pushing that legal envelope. But I think the additional point when you're talking about pass-through restrictions is that even if you can, you know, change the Oregon Constitution and amend and deal with possible state legal issues, I think you also need to check, because I checked with the Brennan Center, and they identified for me the possibility of pass-through restrictions as a standalone policy may well run into federal court challenges, and in fact there's a Ninth Circuit course along these lines. And that basically restrictions on pass-throughs, pack-to-pack transfers, regardless if it's, you know, one principal candidate campaign committee to another one, or, you know, principal candidate committee to, you know, the leadership pack, or, you know, whatever. Typically, those have been found legally defensible when it's part of a bigger package of contribution limits and are needed to make those limit regimes work. In other words, without pass-through restrictions, you'd be a way to get, you know, around, you know, contribution limits. Now, even in that environment, courts typically frown more on bans than restrictions. So I think that's the place to be talking about pass-through restrictions, is in this, you know, other big discussion about campaign finance reform. And even there, like I say, you know, what the courts have found in most other states and at the federal level to be okay, oftentimes is contingent on some level of activity being allowed. So maybe, you know, there's a restriction. But, you know, of course, I get really nervous when you're talking about absolute ban, which I think was another kind of troubling aspect to, you know, the complete ban that was came from the Law Commission. Okay. So the third component, so one's already done. One really needs to be discussed in this whole other context, I would argue.
Okay.
So now let's go to the three and four, which I think is what's the meat of this discussion. And one, again, is already addressed in state law, personal use of campaign funds. And I know some people, I've heard, like, oh, well, this discussion is about personal use of campaign funds. And I think we need to be really clear, and I think that was one of the things that was so great about the memo from Legislative Counsel's office, is that it really just mapped out, like, to the extent that personal use is already dealt with. And that, you know, we're ahead of the curve on this point. I mean, a group similar to mine in North Carolina, I believe it was in the 2005 session, worked hard on a bill to include some of those restrictions we already have on use of campaign funds after several lame duck candidates with pretty significant war chests were making extensive purchases at car dealers across the state of North Carolina and buying cars for themselves and their family, and that was how they were, you know, spending down their campaign funds. So that was addressed with provisions that we kind of already see. But I think that to the extent that legislators do, you know, maybe have some impulse to kind of want to blur that line, is why the pay issue is so important. So I think that you know, this is where the, you know, link, you know, if we're going to tighten up here, we've got to deal with the pay is very, very critical. And then the fourth component relates to the use of campaign funds for official business. And that is where I think it needs to be clearly linked, not just to the absolute compensation, but I think it's really linked more to rethinking what office adequate, what an adequate office budget is, per diem policies. A phrase that I used before Senator Monroe's committee is that I think that there absolutely have to be kind of rural fairness provisions, and I think the need for that has only skyrocketed with the increase in gas costs. So, there I think then you use the example of, like, you know, what do we want? Do we want to, you know, just kind of continue to not quite fund legislative office budgets kind of with the expectation that, oh, well, you know, people will make it up here? And I think you do want to recognize what people really need to do business and boost that up. And, you know, maybe there needs to be some shifts, you know, so there is more, you know, actual reimbursement of, you know, with receipts and all that stuff. I know certainly in my organization, if I send staff on the road, we don't pay a per diem. I need the receipts, you know. So, again, other organizations have dealt with this.
And Janice, I just want to go back to the rural legislator piece. I mean, as I sort of think about it, I mean, gas clearly is part of that in increasing expenses. You know, you can certainly create limited exemptions, and gas being one of them, and it's really hard. I mean, it's really hard to say, okay, this was my campaign gas, this is my legislative gas or whatever.
Right.
You know, that's a really difficult
and
kind of a very
fine. I spent two nights with my brother-in-law, and so here's my personal gas.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But that is one way. I mean, clearly, I assume if we did a tally, rural legislators drive further than urban legislators. I mean,
yeah.
I just would assume that. It's almost like a reverse. It would be a progressive reimbursement system. I mean, that
mm-hmm.
would be one way of sort of compensating for the distance would be to do gas. That was just a thought that I had.
Yes. And, again, other states do, you know, have these distinctions. So, you know, we wouldn't be, you know, inconsistent. Now, in terms of how, in terms of how this, you know, interacts with the.
On the principle, I understand it. And to a certain extent, it has its logic, and there may be concurrent examples that you can show from other states. But just from a practical standpoint, if we did create the requirement that you factor out your mileage, and all of that's sort of subjective, because I'm going to the Rotary, yeah, I'm not going to have a good time.
I always have a good time when I go to Rotary Center.
Well, you don't have to drive 3 hours to get there.
Oh, yeah, I have, trust me.
Okay, well, you probably have now. And on the way, I might, you know, if I'm killing half an hour before I go, I might go to a sporting goods store. You know, now does that.
Senator Ferriero, I'm sorry, go ahead. Right, I thought
so,
you were
done. So the point is, I factor in the political, I factor out the personal, I account for both. You know, and then maybe I drop by and see a legislative constituent on an issue with the Department of Environmental Quality or some other one of our wonderful state agencies. So I've got three factors, and now I'll have to take a three-column concurrent record.
Yeah.
And if I don't do that, or if I get it wrong, is that subject to audit? Who do I turn all that mess into, and where do they audit it? And if I get it wrong, do I get a nasty gram from ethics?
Chair Brown, Senator Ferrioli, I'm not suggesting that you do that.
Yeah.
I am just naming the fact that this is this is the complex world you deal with.
Yeah.
It could be done. If somebody...
All right, so let me make the point using this illustration to make. So I'm going to try and recruit a candidate, and the only way for me to sign a candidate up is just to lie to them about this regulatory framework that they're going to have to exist in. Because if you explain everything that they're required to do, they will just say, you must be crazy.
Well, Senator Ferrioli, if you offer a whatever the salary might be, a $50,000 salary with a solid office budget, some ability to get some expenses reimbursed, or the system we currently have, I'm guessing the candidate would choose the salary. I could be wrong about that. That's the choice you all are going
to
be making.
I think
we're talking about choices here. And if folks want to oppose any kind of legislation along these lines, that's fine. I'm looking for specific suggestions, a way to make this workable, specifically for rural legislators, because I really get the extra burden that the travel time puts on you all. And so...
No, I get it. I appreciate that. My definition is for more simplicity, not more complexity.
Okay.
Madam Chair, Doris Johnson suggested not less than $75,000.
I lived under the $1,200 a month, so, I mean, you know.
So did I.
For many years. So, anyway, I don't think... Janice is trying to make it more complicated.
No.
I think what she's trying to... Well, let her say what she's trying to do.
Well, one of the things that I did do after the legislation was passed is work with John Lindback's office through rulemaking the expenditure coding that is done to identify the purpose of the expenditure. That's done by rule. So, you know... In this post-Senate Bill 10 environment, in this heightened concern about use of campaign funds, I suggested, and they took me up on the suggestion, that one of the coding options now for campaign expenditures is a public office holder expense category. With and at this point, people aren't. That started in. Beginning of this year, I guess, and people are mainly in campaign mode. So I did an Orstar search and didn't find a lot of people kind of using that. And I think it's probably going to take a while for people to, understand how that fits. But my goal here was to try to, using Orstar, to try to, get some data on what people are do feel like they can clearly label as public office holder expenses is distinguished from, you know, their campaign expenses. And people would presumably do that differently. I'm not saying, you know, but it's just, but, and there are folks doing it. And there are some local officials doing it, so.
And a really good example of that would be, for a public office holder expense, would be the OBA dinner for someone who is in the middle of a four-year term or a six-year term. That would be a wonderful identifier for the system, for ORSTAR.
Well, and, I mean, actually, you know, the in terms of the people who are have labeled some expenses in that way, it actually does include some people who are running for office right now and evidently feel like, you know, they can clearly distinguish between some of the things they're doing running for office and some of the things, because they're incumbents, that they are doing in terms of paying for Salem rent and things like that. So there are definitely folks who are, you know, being able to see this. And so, you know, we're a research organization. We like to see the data. And so I was very pleased to have the Elections Division, you know, add this as a kind of reporting option in ORSTAR that, you know, as I say, as people get used to it over time, hopefully will really just help, you know, differentiate and identify what people are doing. So the final thoughts are, so those are kind of like, let's say, the four components. And I think there does need to be consideration of kind of the scope of this discussion. I mean, it was interesting in the I think it was labeled as legislators' use of campaign funds, and I think it is important to recognize that unless you change the law to have it be more narrowly focused to legislators, you know, use of campaign funds provisions apply across the board. And that it is important to keep in mind that not all public officials are elected officials, so not all public officials ever have campaign money in the first place. Which is actually why, you know, one of the recommendations from the Law Commission that was also in Senate Bill 10 about this whole, you know, legal defense fund, I think that was made a lot of sense, because the assumption perhaps that, oh, well, if those things came up, they could deal with campaign funds, flew in the face of the reality of most of our public officials never have campaign funds in the first place. Then, of course, there are also our elected officials who, for whatever reason, don't end up with campaign fund surpluses. So, I mean, one option here, like I say, if you're going to, you know, to the extent that the pass-through restrictions have, you know, constitutional questions related to them, I mean, if you're going to, this is a suggestion that also has legal ramifications, but, I mean, one way to deal with this is that there are some states with what are called spend-out requirements. And, you know, you'll deal with the use of campaign funds issues if you have spend-out requirements, and it means people don't have money after they run. End of subject. So I'm not saying that that's probably going to, you know, rise to the top, but just to name that as an option. Another option is to consider if people want to, you know, establishing office, you know, if people do find that the office holder budgets aren't enough to allow the establishment of separate from your campaign funds. Now, this would be more complex, so again, I'm not suggesting this. I'm just tossing out options, Senator Ferriol, just to, you know, jump to preempt your concern. But there are states that explicitly allow elected officials to set up separate office holder accounts, that their fundraising is, you know, explicitly to, you know, I'm raising money for my office holder account, and, you know, blah, blah, blah.
It's a library.
Whatever, right. And that in general, I just think it's also important to really identify the difficulty of you're writing the rules that deal with all these circumstances. So already, you know, there's been lots of discussions about, you know, the gift and multiple purpose trips. And I think And some of this, but another example that can come up sometimes in the press in a way that I kind of always groan about, because it just, you know, it's these example, it's these kind of, you know, not very common circumstances that unfortunately kind of get more attention and kind of undermine people's confidence. That I think it's also difficult to write rules to help differentiate between legitimate campaign expenses, and then just use like election night. I would argue that, you know, election night party expenses is a perfectly acceptable use of campaign funds. But what happens when, you know, the candidate rents a limo, starts to bar hop, and is, you know, between, is not just going to his or her election night party, but is going to numerous election night parties. And, you know, and I bring this up because there is, in history, there has been an example along these lines that when I've talked with reporters about this topic, that's where they'll go. And it's frustrating to me, so I'm sure it's frustrating to you. But I just want to name the extent to which I don't think, you know, you're ever going to, I mean, I asked the reporter, how would you write a rule to differentiate this? And so I think there just does need to be some recognition in that regard that if this kind of situation came up, that it's kind of more of a legislative conduct issue, and to potentially think about it in that way. But I think this is also an example when sometimes you'll get into use of campaign funds where the consequences are really political. And I don't think it's a coincidence that somebody who was involved in some of these kinds of stories is, you know, no longer an elected official. So I think that speaks to, I just want to name the fact that I don't know that you can like write laws and rules and that will deal with absolutely every contingency.
Questions? Are off the hook. Thank you very much. Cappy, Dan, it's great to see you guys. Next meeting, I have had numerous conversations with Representative Diane Rosenbaum, who chairs the House Elections Committee. And I anticipate we will have a discussion about trying to do a joint meeting to look at some of the attempts to reform our campaign finance system, and there may be some other issues that will come up. That meeting will be held in September. We don't have a date or a location yet. I think we're also trying to coordinate with the Senate Rules and the House Ethics Committee, so it may be we have them all in one day to avoid multiple trips for our legislators that need to travel many miles.
French Glen.
French Glen, okay.
Great place to have
it. It is, I'm sure. Can you guarantee a turnout?
I can guarantee a location. Go to the school.
So happy to hear your input. Send our best wishes to Senator Ackland.
Shall we?
Thanks, everybody. I appreciate you being here today and appreciate the discussion. And I guess with that, we are, unless there's any further business to come to our committee, we are adjourned. Thanks.